Judiciary Committee is called to order. Members, take your seats. A quorum is present. Members, today we have six bills. House File 5, paid medical leave. Representative Halverson is already at the table. Nice job, Representative Halverson. 1503, tribal access to vital record data. 1138, digital fare repair. 804, data practices legislative commission. This is going to be re-referred to Ways and Means. 1511, eviction case court files, discretionary and mandatory expungement. House File 2004, human rights providing unredacted information to parties in a closed case. And House File 2062, classifying data collected under the Workforce Certificate of Compliance. That sounds like an exciting one. But we're going to be ready on all these. The first order of business is approval of the minutes from March 11th. Do I have a motion? Representative Noor moves the motions of March 11th. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye. 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 All opposed, say no. Motion passes. The minutes of March 11th are adopted. Representative Halverson, House File 5. You have an amendment labeled A8. Is that right?
That's
Do you have someone who you want to move that amendment to put the bill in the form you so desire? Representative Herr, I bet, will do it. Representative Herr moves the A8 amendment. Any discussion on this amendment? Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm wondering if the author could point out in this 13-page amendment, that's not a delete-all, but a line-in-word amendment, if she could point out the areas of this amendment that apply to our committee.
Representative Halverson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to ask Mr. Weeks to address that question.
Go ahead, Mr. Weeks. Point out the areas in the amendment that are going to be up for consideration in this committee.
Mr. Chair, members, the data, treatment of data within the bill, the House File 5, is in the first article, and I do not believe anything in the amendment changes anything in that article. Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. So it doesn't affect the treatment of data under the new program created in House File 5.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Chair Scott.
If House Research that is at the table could point out the page and line of the amendment.
Hey, Chair Scott, you ask that question again? You want House Research to point out a page and line of the amendment?
Of the amendment that applies to this committee.
Oh, that applied to the committee. Okay. I don't know. Anyone in research want to answer that? Chair Scott.
The House Researcher at the table. Sorry, Ben.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Weeks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, so I'm focusing specifically on data practices, which I understand is under the purview of this committee. There's nothing in the amendment that changes the treatment of data practices under House File 5 in the amendment.
Okay. Well, this committee has data practices, judiciary, civil law, pretty much everything, but I don't know. If you're focusing just on data practices and there's nothing in the amendment relating to data practices, is that answer adequate for you, Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anything in here on penalties or anything at all in this amendment that falls under our purview?
Mr. Weeks, appeal process is in here, I think.
Chair Lesh and Representative Scott, the amendment changes a number of substantive parts of House File 5 that are all protected by a private right of action for people who have their rights under the section violated. So in that regard, significant part of the amendment would fall under this committee's purview for civil law.
Okay, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would move to that this committee would only take the parts of this amendment that apply to this, and the rest of this amendment, I think, should cause this bill to go back to Commerce, since that has the major purview over this new system that we're setting up through this bill. And so I would move to strike all provisions of the amendment not relating to the judiciary.
Okay. Chair Scott has moved to strike all portions of this amendment not relating to judiciary. Can you specify which sections you want to strike, Chair Scott?
Well, I would ask for House Research's help with that, but I guess that would be Anything that does not have to do with appeals on page 11.7 through 11.14. And I know Mr. Weeks pointed out something about private right of action, so if that's in here, I'm not sure the page and line of that, but it sounds like those are the only two areas of this amendment that apply.
Okay, so can you just restate what your amendment is? You want to strike 11.7 through 11.14 and
I want to strike all of the A8 amendment except for 11.7 through 11.14. And then if Mr. Weeks could point out the area that applies to the private right of action, that would also be my amendment, that portion to save and delete everything else.
Okay. So Chair Scott, just to restate so I understand it, you're going to delete everything in the 8 amendment with the exception of lines 11.7 to line 11.14. That is the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. No.
Division.
Motion
Chair?
Does not prevail. Division has been called. All in, I forgot how we do division. Just raise your hands, right? Yeah.
Right.
Okay. All in favor, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All opposed, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chair?
Chair Scott.
That I would move that this bill be sent back to the Commerce Committee since this amendment primarily deals with things covered under that committee's purview, not ours. And since this is such a substantial amendment, I just feel like it's not proper for our committee to be taking up something that's so substantially out of our purview.
Okay, so the motion is that, restate the motion.
I would move that this bill and this amendment be moved back to Commerce, that we wouldn't take this bill up this morning because these changes are not under our purview.
Okay, so that motion is out of order. We just voted down the amendment.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, then I would amend that. I'd just say that this bill needs to go back to Commerce, and that should be the motion.
Okay. We can't send, this is supposed to go to Ways and Means. We can't even send it to Commerce, can we? Well, she moved it, it's going to send it to Commerce, even though we can't do it. So, okay, the motion is to send House File 5 to Commerce. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. 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 Motion does not prevail. We're back to the amendment. The A8 amendment. All in favor of the A8 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
No. Motion prevails. Two-year bill as amended. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 5 is a bill for paid family and medical leave. The purpose of the bill is to create a system which is tied to our current and longstanding unemployment insurance benefit. I shouldn't say tied to, but mirrored by our longstanding unemployment insurance to provide paid family and medical leave for all Minnesota workers. So that they can have a baby, deliver safely, take care of medical needs while they are pregnant, take care of their own medical needs if you are diagnosed with cancer or serious illness, if you have a family member who is diagnosed with cancer or has a serious illness, you would get to take up to 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave. There are small amounts of circumstances where a person could take up to 24 weeks, but that would necessitate a high-risk pregnancy coupled with a long-term, a 12-week medical leave. And all of the leave requirements are processed through an application from DEED. They're certified by a medical professional and believe is affirmed through an application process. We have heard many times from small employers who are looking for this kind of option and in order to compete in the workplace. And we've also heard from many folks who are caregivers or who manage caregivers who recognize that there's a tremendous cost that's being paid by Minnesota workers and Minnesota employers because Minnesotans have to choose between having a paycheck and caring for a loved one or caring for themselves. This makes it so that Minnesotans don't have to choose. And, Mr. Chair, I understand that there are just certain parts of this bill that are under your purview. However, I would say that although the amendment is long, we have worked very hard with stakeholders every stop along the way and made promise changes based on discussion and will carry other ideas and changes from this committee forward to the next. Our next stop is Ways and Means with a recommendation to jobs. One of the reasons this is such a long amendment is that it actually conforms much of what was in the bill, much of the definition to paid family and medical leave at the federal level. I shouldn't say paid, unpaid, the family medical leave. And so it was requests from employers who said we want to have language and definitions that we're familiar with. And so this hopefully will help cut down on the number of compliance officers that people need because employers are already working with this language in other parts of law. That is a brief opening.
Okay. Thank you very much. Do you have other testifiers?
I do, Mr. Chair.
If you could bring them up and speak to just those portions of the bill that are under the purview of this committee. Please come up to the testifier's table. If you have another one who's going to come and testify after this, Representative Halverson, please have them be ready to go. So come on, go ahead and take your seat and introduce yourself for the record. Begin your testimony to those portions of this bill that are before the committee. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christy Hall, and I am the senior staff attorney at Gender Justice, a legal advocacy organization. And I'm here to testify about the enforcement mechanisms in this bill, including a private right of action. I think enforcement mechanisms are essential to the operation of a new law like this. And I think enforcement mechanisms are in everybody's interest. If people are able to gain a competitive advantage by violating the law with no consequences, that only harms employers who are looking to follow the law. So I think both for the benefit of people who want to use their earned time here and for employers as well who want to follow the law, the private right of action is an essential enforcement mechanism. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will be available if there are questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Hall. Next testifier, please state your name and begin your testimony.
My name is Daniel Swensenclad. I'm the owner of Butter Bakery Cafe in Minneapolis. And thank you, Chairperson Lesh and members of the committee.
You didn't bring any?
Nothing today, unfortunately. I was stepping in for another member who was going to testify today, and if I had I planned, I would have thought about it, especially lemon bars, perhaps. But
please don't rub salt.
I'm actually here today with a cook who is ready to go on parental leave at any point. He announced yesterday dilation had begun, and they were getting ready. I unfortunately have, as a small business owner, really have no mechanism to handle paid medical family leave, but we're going to do it. I'm going to give him 3 weeks and pay for him. It's going to be costly, but he's valuable to me. He's one of my four cooks. I hope he will be back because it's a hard position to fill. And so this is, if I had a little more support at a state level, like I do for work comp, when one of my bakers spilled some caramel on her hand, I'd find my business a little less complex and a little less concerning, and perhaps would remember lemon bars on days like this.
Again,
I've trusted the system to work for me for working with unemployment requests, with working with work comp requests. I check a little box in my payroll system. I fill out a couple forms, and things work. I've been very happy to have that happen over the last 13, 14 years. Paid family medical leave, I had three folks go out last year for paid medical leave, as well as for babies. It's nice to have children being born into our shop. But it's really complex, and I can't say that my filing and my data systems and my national headquarters at my house do a very good job of it. I'd really prefer to have the systems behind me that I have at the state level. I trust Deed. They've done a good job for me. I appreciate that you're using that system as a way to make this work.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Swenson-Platt. President Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the testifier?
You know, let's wait until the end. Can we wait until all the testifiers come up? I've got...
I'll wait.
Thank you. I got Nikki Shiljongnim. Did I say that right?
I'm not Nikki, but...
Oh, so no, probably.
I'm Sarah Piepenberg.
You're not on the list. Okay. Wait, are you going to speak to just the portions of this bill that we have? Okay, go ahead.
My name is Sarah Piepenberg. I own a small retail oil and vinegar shop in Minneapolis, Excelsior, and Navarre. I've testified before why I think we need this based on my employees, but I'm here today to say that I trust that Deed can create a system to keep employee data safe. They're currently doing it already, and they have systems in place to keep unemployment records and data safe. This shouldn't be a question or concern if we're not questioning or concerning have concerns about what they're currently doing. The bigger issue is we need a statewide paid family and medical leave. Minnesota has the opportunity to set the bar for paid family and medical leave. We have great systems already in place. We've set the bar for voter turnout, and I think one of the reasons is because we have systems in place like same-day voter registration. We as Minnesota and the legislature can create these systems. We have proof that it's working in many, many other areas. And I just want to say that I feel like Deed has the capacity and the understanding and the ability to do the right thing in creating a system. Because right now you're entrusting me as an employer to keep my employees' data safe, which consists of a locked file cabinet. There's not a whole lot of safety in that. So I urge you to continue this discussion, and I hope that we can pass paid family and medical leave.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Piepenberg. Nancy Lepping. Commissioner Lepping, I should say. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Lepping. If you could just keep your testimony restricted to the portions of the bill that we have. Thank you.
So, good morning, Chair and members. I'm Nancy Lepping, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. This bill is a cornerstone of the Walz-Flanagan administration's legislative agenda for this session. This bill provides for leave that is not a nice to have, but it's a need to have. The portions of the bill related to data practices and sharing of data between the Department of Labor and the Department of Employment and Economic Development are critical to their and important to their efficient and effective administration and enforcement of the bill, and will create efficiencies for workers and employers, because this will mean that information related to applying for this leave can be shared between the Department of Labor and Department of Labor and Industry and Department of Deed, and will not obligate these workers and employers to provide this information twice, once to the Department of Labor and once to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Also, with regard to the enforcement and compliance authority that's set out in the bill for both Deed and the Department of Labor, these will be critical provisions for protecting the rights of workers, but also to assist employers in meeting their responsibilities under the Act. So consequently, the Department of Labor and Industry, and I speak also for the Department of Employment and Economic Development, that these are provisions that are important to our effective and efficient administration and enforcement of the bill. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Commissioner Lepping. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill related to the items before this committee? Seeing none, then Representative Lucero, your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question would be for both of the first two testifiers. They both had made comments to the effect of they trust deed to protect their data more than they could. And my question is, given the track record of government technology systems, such as MNLARS, such as MNsure, such as other government systems that we've seen who've all suffered data breaches, why do you believe that government can protect better, given their poor track record, than you could?
Mr. Swensenklatt.
Thank you for your question. And indeed, my son spent many months waiting for his driver's license and was a little frustrated at the system. I'm really actually, after 14 years of working with the unemployment system, with the work comp system, with the all of the state income taxes and things that come back and forth, I believe that structure has been in place well enough to support our business pretty well. I don't think adding this layer is going to make an effect on that. I don't see that happening.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then to the bill author, with the amendment, I haven't had the chance to go through it, but with the original language, my understanding is that this would be a completely new technology system, not part of any additional or add-on to any existing system. Can you confirm that's still the case, or is my understanding correct with the adoption of the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Okay, hold on. Representative Halverson, go ahead first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment does not change how this system is being built. And the way it's being built is it's being built as a parallel to something that has worked in Minnesota for over 80 years, I believe, and that is unemployment insurance. We have had systems in place to apply for and distribute unemployment insurance benefits, and this is being built to mirror that already very successful program. So it isn't all brand new. It's something that is being built in parallel with another program.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to correct a statement before we go on. As far as I'm aware, there were no data breaches in MNLARS or MNsure. There are other issues, but MNsure, I don't recall a data breach, and we're checking, but, you know.
Good point.
Yeah.
And
Mr. Chair.
Some of this is the problem of private contractors, too, I think, as well. But
Mr. Chair.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. That's inaccurate. There was a data breach very early in the beginning with MNsure where someone inadvertently sent hundreds of people's Social Security numbers and names out to several insurance companies, insurance providers, I guess, the agencies is a more accurate word. And I don't know about MNLARS specifically, but the Department of Public Safety, the Division of Motor Vehicle Services, had a very large data breach online where you could go online and find other people's information. They were posting online. They had available online people's personal information without their knowledge. So this has already happened, and I just wanted to point that out.
You're saying they have a better track record than Facebook or Target. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's exactly what I was going to say is, yes, there was a data breach. And Representative Liebling, I've actually been tracking the different data breaches and failures of state agency technology systems. And so I think it's a misplaced idea that government can protect your data better than a smaller agency or smaller system from an employer. Continuing on with the question to the bill author, the bill author just referenced that this is a system that would be built in parallel, but my understanding from reading the language, and I'm looking for my highlights here, that there's an explicit exclusion. There it is. It's on the original bill now. I don't know if it changed with the amendment, but it's line 10.6 and 10.7. There's an explicit exemption from using Minute and other technology systems. So my understanding is that this proposal would be a new system with new servers, new network, new staff, new code. While you can say that the idea in concept is similar to an existing, the technology system itself would be brand new. Is that correct?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero, that is up to the department.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, then I guess my third question, and I'll end for now, would be we've heard several references to deed, but my understanding from the bill language is it's the Department of Commerce and the Department of Labor and Industry that's in scope here, not deed. Is that correct? That would be the controllers or builders of this technology system.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero, no, it would be the Department of Economic Employment and Economic Development. That would house this program just as UI is housed there. And the Department of Labor and Industry would be responsible for any enforcement and oversight.
Representative Lucero, last question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, that the technology system would be built, managed, and run by Deed.
Representative Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, just as UI is currently, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesch, members, I do have a question for the two testifiers that own businesses.
Come on up. Go ahead. Ask your question while they're coming down, Chair Johnson.
They talked how good this program would be for their business. I'm just wondering, and how good it would be for their employees. I'm wondering if they're offering this now, because there is a lot of business that offer programs like this in the private industry, and also in the public as well. I'm just wondering if they are offering it now to their employees.
Mr. Swensenklatt or Ms. Peppenberg, go ahead.
Yes, actually. I have an employee right out right now who's out on 12 weeks. She had a hip replacement and is going to be followed by a knee replacement. I'm paying for her right now out of pocket, covering then her shifts, trying to find childcare. If this system was in place, it would be less expensive, actually, for me. I have, as a business owner for the last 10 years, researched opportunities through private insurers to do this. It is unaffordable, crazily unaffordable. This equates to about a cup of coffee a week for me as an employer. I'm willing, actually, to even pay more because what is offered on the private market is unacceptable. It would be over $400 a month for me to get a two-week paid family or medical leave through private insurance companies. So please trust, for the last 10 years, I have absolutely been looking. This is an affordable option for me as a business owner.
Chair Johnson.
Okay. So I know a lot of companies that offer the short-term disability.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them are paying that price. I don't know where you're getting your quotes, but I'd change insurance companies. That is very much out of line. You're talking about how much, you're talking about how expensive it is for you, and that you don't want to pay for this. Or you'll pay a little bit, not the whole fare that an offer that you're offering your employees. So if you're not going to pay for it, who do you want to pay for it?
No, this is an affordable option.
Ms. Diepenberg, sorry, this is a whole little game we play here in committee. It's like you go through the chair, and then I call on them, and they call on you. It's like a little game thing. Sorry, go ahead, Ms. Diepenberg.
This, at a rate of 0.031%, is one of those opportunities, because I am going to provide it, regardless if anybody else is going to help me, because it's the right thing to do for our employees. I have a retail business with an 87% turnover rate. I don't have turnover. The reason being is because I pay more than minimum wage. I am flexible as far as sick time. Minneapolis did not have to dictate to me to have a paid sick time. We have these policies. This is a policy that I would like to offer my employees, and it's at a rate that is affordable. For businesses that already have paid family and medical leave and those kinds of things, they have the opportunity to opt out. All they have to do is prove that they're providing the minimum. And this, for me, is a bar that we can set in the state of Minnesota. And we have had other business owners testify to that effect, that they can actually offer more to their employees, because right now they're only offering 3 to 4 weeks. This would be an affordable option to give their employees up to 12 weeks paid leave. The other piece for me as a business owner, I have the opportunity to purchase it for myself. And as a business owner, I will be also putting my name in this if this passes.
Chair Johnson. Chair Lesh, on to the testifiers. You explained, showed one of the problems. Good employees will offer good packages to keep their employees. Now, if we do something like this, and if you're going to go on this, there's no incentive for your employees to stay. They can move around. Because it's the way this is set up, their benefits move with them. And as a business, if I was a business owner and I'm looking for new employees, I go through the system and look what their benefits they have racked up. You're going to have to be a very good employee for me to even consider hiring somebody that could work for 2 days and they're going to be out for 12 weeks. If you don't think people would look at that, you're crazy.
Well, okay.
But I will say this as I finish up here, just one final statement. A lot of companies have got away from sick time. They've gone to personal time off. There's a reason for that, because sick time is the number one abused perk that there is. When I worked in law enforcement, I worked on a 28-day rotating schedule. My partner was there a lot longer than I was. He worked the opposite side of it. We worked for 4 days at a time. That 4 days out of 28 days, we were together. 3.5 of those days, he usually took a sick day. When he actually needed sick time, he didn't have any because he used it up because he abused it. I ended up with, I didn't abuse my sick time. Up until I had neck surgery for a double fusion in my neck, I had given more sick time away than I had used. But I had it available for when I needed it. The problem is the abuse of the system that's causing this. And this isn't going to stop the abuse, and it's going to make actually things worse, I believe.
Rips of her.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. I guess I'm just a little bit baffled by the line of questioning that just happened here, and I don't really know what's going on. But I do just want to say that last year, St. Paul, I was the policy director for Mayor Carter. We passed $15 minimum wage last year, year before the Earn Sick and Save Time. We know that we keep asking our businesses to actually do more for employees, because we know that especially in the small business, medium-sized businesses, it is really difficult, and margins are really small. And depending on which industries you're in, the margins are even smaller, right? And so when I see small businesses do what all of you are doing and saying, we've been looking for options, we're trying to do best by employees, we know that when we take care of our employees, morale is up. People choose to stay. We understand all of the great benefits that come with this. So I guess I'm just a little bit confused about the questioning and the interrogating as if you're doing something wrong here. And I just wanted to congratulate you and thank you, because even in the city of St. Paul, we're looking out to say, how do we pull, right, large businesses have the ability to pull employees so that they can get lower rates, they can get better insurance, they can get better benefits. You don't have that option in small businesses. And so to be able to, for us as a state to say, what can we do? Because we've been asking more out of you every single day, every single year, that what can we do to help support all of you? So I really just appreciate the efforts that are being done here. I appreciate this bill being brought forward, and I appreciate the work that's being done here. And I guess my only question would be is that, you know, the way this is set up, do you all feel like it is the right structure to allow your businesses to continue to flourish, but to treat your employees well? And you know, and do you feel that this would be the right tool in order to do that?
Ms. Papenberg.
I absolutely do feel like this would be the right tool. And if I can address some of his questions or concerns, we're vilifying employees. What we're doing is setting a bar.
Here's the deal. Yeah. We've already gone way over the time we allotted for this bill, and we've also gone way far afield of why this bill is here. So, Ms. Papenberg, if you can speak to the question as it relates to why we're here. I permitted Chair Johnson wide latitude, but considering where we are, I'd like to narrow that back in. So can you speak to the question as it relates to the data practices or creation of the data set?
Well, I do feel that this gives me an opportunity. In looking through private insurance, this is an affordable option for me as an employer.
Okay. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always amazed when you have somebody that has a benefit, has benefited through their whole career, and then wants to deny it to other people.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, did you have a question or comment? Go ahead.
Yes,
and then
Mr.
We're gonna
Chair,
vote.
To the bill and actually to the sections that we're supposed to be addressing.
Thank you.
You're welcome, awesome. Chair. So I actually have a real question to the bill author. Thank you for bringing this. If you could look at page 10, and I'll give you exactly page and line. I'm just trying to understand some process things that relate directly to this committee. Page 10, line 25 through 29, talks about records release. And I'll, are you there? I don't want to do it.
Yep.
Okay,
thank you.
Perfect. Okay, so I just don't want you to be the last one we're talking about. So specifically to records release. Now, you say that an individual whose medical records are necessary to determine eligibility, and it goes on from there. So unlike unemployment insurance, where the individual is applying for themselves, this could be someone applying for someone else, maybe a spouse, maybe a child, maybe someone they're caring for. Can you explain to me the process that you would get someone's medical records that are not your own? And your, have you thought through that process? And then retention. So once those medical records have been provided, I don't believe in the bill it addresses how long retention is for these very private records. And if you could speak to those two aspects.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I would like to introduce Ms. Fitzpatrick to speak to the technical support of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Fitzpatrick. I co-direct the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the Humphrey School and had the contract to do the design and implementation study on this policy for the state of Minnesota in 2016. So, Representative O'Neill, actually the care recipient is the one who has to sign off on the sharing of their data. So it's kind of a two-part process for those folks that are applying for benefits to take care of another person. The care recipient actually is the one that has to, in that case, approve of their medical information being shared. And usually in these cases, the actual data, the actual medical record isn't shared, but information about the person's condition is shared, which is a function of how long that employee or that care, you know, giver would need to be out. And that is related to the type of medical condition that they have.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, I don't see that language in the bill. Maybe you could point to where care recipient is in it and defined so that's clear, because in section subsection 6, which was 10.25 through 10.29, it just says individual. It doesn't say the care recipient. Maybe that clarification would be important. And I have a little bit of concern that it's more of not anecdotal, but it's more of a story as opposed to actual substantiation from medical records, that there's actually an issue going on. And if that's truly the case, that in the language itself, it actually says authorizing a release of medical records. So it's different. The language is different than what you just described. And I'm a little confused, because one is kind of telling a story, well, this is the condition and this is how long it's been going on. But this is, it actually says authorization of release of medical records or other records, if you could clarify that.
Ms. Who are you asking? Ms.
To the author, sorry.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, the process that's laid out through the bill actually requires sign-off from a medical practitioner, so it's not just anecdotal. It's actually driven by the authorization of practitioners like we do with other types of benefits in the state. And this is an as necessary, so it is a if for some reason the application needs more research or a appeal needs more documentation in order for somebody's appeal to be successful if their benefits were denied. There may be required more authorization, but or more records, but the records are not deemed required at the outset. It's only if they are necessary further in the process.
Representative O'Neill, last question.
Absolutely. Just to wrap up, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I still have a concern about retention. It's not specifically laid out in the bill as far as how long that data could be retained, because you are talking about very private medical records, not just an anecdote of their condition. And so I would guess, I think that's something that should be spelled out, and that
I'd appreciate that moving forward. And maybe that you have a thought as to how long that might be. I don't know. But.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, quickly, I would just say that I will talk to the commissioner and get some information and also see how HIPAA fits into this as well, because it's got language that's similar to HIPAA in terms of the limited extent necessary, and so we will look into that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions, one with the appeals process and one with employer penalties. To start with the appeals process, on line 13.21 to 22, it says the commissioner may adopt rules on procedures for hearings. The rules need not conform to common law or statutory rules of evidence and other technical rules of procedure. And I'm just wondering, since those traditional laws or rules of a hearing process for it to be fair and equitable are not going to be applied here, what guarantees do we have that the appeals process will be fair? And do other statutes give the commissioner similar authority and power?
Well, okay. I mean, Ms. Fitzpatrick, did you want to answer that? I mean,
well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to say that for the most part, this appeals process that's picked up in this bill is coming from UI, and so that language that you're referencing, just confirmed with Ben Weeks, is basically building off of that same kind of a exclusion in UI.
Okay. Thank you,
Scott.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could go to the section on page 21, and I apologize, I haven't written in the lines if any of this has changed with the 13-page amendment or not, but on lines 21, starting at 21.16, talks about the employer penalties, and is that also, is this also similar to unemployment insurance?
Representative Halverson. Anyone?
Conferring with staff.
Okay, we're conferring. We're calling a friend.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, no, these are not from UI. These are new penalties that would be available to the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development for noncompliance with a employer's adoption of a private plan to provide the same benefits that are provided under the bill. But they're new. It's a new concept.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And thanks, Mr. Chair. And so I'm just wondering, is number one to the bill's author, is this section addressed in the 13-page amendment? And if so, where? And then I'd also like to hear, if there's anybody in the audience from the business community, I'd like to hear their thoughts on the employer penalty section of this bill.
Chair Scott, we're way over time, so I'm not going to call for anyone to give their thoughts on it. If you have a specific question for someone, go ahead and ask that question.
Okay. Ms. Larson, she's available from Chamber or Business Partnership, I forget what.
Okay, what's your question, Chair Scott?
I'd just like to get their feedback on the employer penalty section of this bill, since that does apply to our
Go ahead, Ms. Larson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Jill Larson with Minnesota Business Partnership. Yeah, we do have some concerns with the penalty section in the bill. We do feel like the penalties are a little onerous. The way the bill's drafted right now, it will make it very difficult for an employer to have a private plan for those employers that want to be able to provide their own benefits to their employees. There's a lot of hoops to jump through, and there are a lot of the penalties in the bill really create a disincentive for an employer to have a private plan, including the commissioner's ability to revoke a plan and not allow a plan to be reapplied for 3 years. It's not clear under what conditions a plan would be able to be revoked. So we are concerned. We think some of these penalties are a little onerous, and you know, what we believe should just be a wage replacement proposal, we feel, has kind of turned into more of a some pretty bureaucratic and penalizing provisions against employers who are actually providing the benefit now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lucero, you have the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Because you already spoke.
I was just going to say, I'll just save my questions for the House floor because it'll go beyond what you're looking
for. Thank you, Representative Lucero. There being no other comments, did we ask if anyone else is going to come up and testify on it? Didn't we?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, we did that. Okay, the chair will renew his motion that House File 5, as amended, be re-referred to...
Well, Mr. Chair, we didn't offer my amendment. I had the A9.
You didn't offer your amendment, Chair
Scott. Well, is there opportunity for me to offer that amendment,
Mr.
Chair?
I'm carrying your water for you here. What's the A9?
The A9, what it would do is require that the data must be encrypted when it travels from one entity, one agency to the other. Then there's some other provisions in this that we've been putting in statute. Anytime that data is being shared, we've traditionally been doing this in the last few years, Mr. Chair. Establish written procedures, role-based access, audit trails, those sorts of things that are in this amendment. So I would offer the A9.
Okay.
And after people's
Scott offers the A9 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. No. Motion does not prevail. We're back on the bill. House renews his motion. The House file five. Chair, what did I say? House renews? Not House. Chair renews his motion. That House file 5, as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Next bill is Representative Becker Finn's House File 1503, Tribal Access to Vital Record Data. Chair moves House File 1503 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative Becker Finn, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You guys are fun. So House File 1503 would essentially give tribal health departments and tribal governments access, the same access to important birth data that other local governments currently have.
Okay, excellent. Do you have a testifier, Representative Becker Finn?
I do have a testifier, although I don't know if people have... she's mostly here to answer questions. We're just trying...
Questions. Anyone have questions? What's your name, testifier?
Good morning. I'm Molly Crawford. I'm the State Registrar for the Minnesota Department of Health, Office of Vital Records.
Excellent. Anyone have any questions for the author or for Ms. Crawford on this bill? Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Becker Finn. I'm just wondering if you know why tribal officials aren't allowed this data currently.
I didn't hear the question. Say again, Chair Johnson.
I was just wondering if Representative Becker Finn knew why the tribal officials are not allowed that data at this time.
Oh, do you know the answer to that question, Representative Becker Finn?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, I believe, or Representative Johnson, I believe it's an oversight. We have a long way to go in recognizing tribal sovereignty and the way we treat tribal governments.
Chair Johnson.
I'm not sure, Chair Lesh, Representative Becker Finn, I'm not sure if it's an oversight or not, but it would have to be a two-way street. Right now, we had an incident in not far from my district where the state was asked to go in to audit an issue in one of the tribal grounds, and the state auditor's office informed the jurisdiction that was looking for the audit that the state did not have authorization because they were a sovereign nation.
Thank you. Any other questions for the author or for the question taker, Ms. Crawford? Seeing none, then Chair renews his Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Representative Becker Finn, I just had a quick question because I know I was doing research on birth data as I was working at the College Savings Account for the City of St. Paul, and birth records that are, so children born to parents who are married, those records are always public, but children born to a parent who is not married, that data is actually private, confidential, which means even the child doesn't have access to that data until they turn 18 and they request it themselves. And so I'm just curious as to, and we wanted to use that data actually to do something really good for children born in St. Paul. I guess I was just curious as to how, is this different, does this then change that for just tribal nations? Because right now children born to a single mother. That data still is private right now. And then the second question is just that for the birth records that are being asked here to be made public, is it just for tribal use of it for something specific, or is it just so that they can have access to the data so that they can do something with it? I just want to make sure I maybe understand a little bit.
Ms. Crockford.
Happy to answer that, Chairman. Members of the committee, the statute now currently carves out very specific data classifications for vital records. And the representative is correct. Births to married mothers are public birth records for the children. Births to unmarried mothers, default confidential unless that mother chooses to make that child's birth record public at the time of the birth registration. This bill does not change any of that. What this bill does is allow us at the Department of Health to share birth data with tribal entities like we already share for local, state, and federal government entities. It is very specific about the type of data that can be shared. The health data on the records is used for local public health, and it would be used for tribal public health in their work with home visiting and working with families to assure that they have the support and services they need. Other information such as demographic and names would be shared with tribal entities like we share currently for child support under the Department of Human Services with the county offices. The changes would also allow public birth records to have certificates issued to tribal, local, state, and federal government entities for the purposes of doing the work that those agencies do.
Thank you. Reps of her.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. I just wanted to say that I think that this is such a I completely support this bill and what it's trying to do. As we move towards understanding that in order for us to support the systemic changes that we want to make right within our structures, that we have to start at birth. And that we have to do that in order to that we need to have access to birth records so that we can identify children who may be at most vulnerable most at risk and to be able to provide the supports and the services that they need from the minute that child is born. And so I really appreciate the efforts being made in this and how this is going to be used and how it's going to operate in the lives of people who really need this. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, then the chair renews his motion that House File 1503 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We now have House File 1138. Representative Fisher is here. Yeah, he's here. Do we have a motion to place House File 1138 on the general register? Representative Neuer moves that House File 1138 be placed on the general register. The bill's before us. You have an A3 amendment?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Someone offer the A3 amendment? Representative Neuer also offers the A3 amendment. Do you want to explain the amendment?
Yes, very quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an author's amendment which clarifies the exclusion section of the bill. This is language that has been agreed to between various proponents of the bill, Medical Ally and Medtronic, to help address some of the concerns from the medical industry.
Okay. Any questions? No. Then Representative Neuer's motion is that we pass the A3 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A3 amendment is adopted to your bill as amended. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 1138. The purpose of this legislation is fourfold: to give consumers the choice, especially in greater Minnesota, of where to bring their electronic products when they require repair, to support and grow small businesses' jobs, to guarantee free market access, and to help reduce the growing amount of e-waste that is harming our environment. House File 1138 requires original equipment manufacturers, known as OEMs, to make available instructions, parts, and tools to independent repair businesses and or consumers to fix electronic equipment. The bill does not force trade secrets to be revealed, no computer source code exposed, and data privacy is protected, and last but not least, the liability of the manufacturer is protected. Members, there's also national and state precedents for this bill. House File 1138 is similar to a bill in Massachusetts which requires auto manufacturers to share information, parts, and tools with local car repair shops. And as you see in one of the handouts, federal laws and regulations as well as state law already speak to the issue of House File 1138 and product liability. Bottom line, Mr. Chair and committee members, if you can choose where to get the best services for your car needs, you should be able to choose where you get your phone or anything else electronic fixed with all necessary and accessible information. Mr. Chair, to give you a little bit more perspective, I do have several testifiers with me.
Please bring them up.
Okay.
Let me see, Jennifer Larson, Gary Wordish, Terry Mikulicki. Mikulicki. You're writing again, isn't it? Yeah, okay. Amos Briggs, Tim Schaefer. That's it. Take care, y'all. Don't say the same thing, okay? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about the Fair Repair Bill. My name is Jennifer Larson. I'm the owner and CEO of Vibrant Technologies. We are in the business of reselling refurbished servers, storage, and networking, and we employ 70 people, and we've been in business 20 years. Over that time, the OEMs, or original equipment manufacturers, have become increasingly monopolistic in their behavior, abusing their market power and forcing consumers to repair their products they purchase through their own OEM channels. I'm a very proud Republican and active, and I believe that government intervention is usually not the answer to most issues. I believe in free markets. But with the changes brought on by the digital age, manufacturers are increasingly able to eliminate our property rights. Once you've purchased their product, there is no longer a free market for anything else you want to do with it. No fully free market for repairing it, no fully free market for customizing it to suit your needs, and no fully free market to resell it. Through our inability to do whatever we please with our products, do we ever actually own them anymore? OEMs are abusing the intent of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to restrict our ability to control the life cycle of the products and forcing on us their strategy of controlled obsolescence. It's extremely profitable for the OEMs, but it steals money from consumers at every step downstream. As the world becomes more digital, this issue will become bigger and more challenging. This bill is an important step to stand up to these abuses. It is beneficial for small businesses. It's good for the economy by giving lower cost alternatives to schools, nonprofits, startups. Good for all consumers, and by extending the life cycle of technology, it's beneficial for our environment. It is only bad for the OEMs that want to squash the free market and run roughshod over our property rights of small businesses and consumers. I ask you for your support of the Fair Repair Bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Larson. Gary Wordish. We'll save questions at the end, members. Please introduce yourself for the record. Don't fall down. And your testimony.
Mr. Chair and representatives, Gary Wordish, I'm president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, a farm out in Renville County. Been doing that all my life. And times have changed from when I first started farming to now. You know, the equipment we drove then to the equipment we drive now, we certainly don't want to go back. You know, it's a pleasure driving the equipment. So technology is great. But it's also got a downside, too. And I get what our members are asking for is a lot of times right now there's so much data. Everything's controlled by a computer or whatever it is. And you can be down sometimes for a very simple thing. And, you know, time is money. Just a few years ago, we had one of our tractors that went down and needed a new software in a dash, needed a complete new dash. And we had to wait a day before the dealer was able to come out and look at it. Then we had to wait another couple of days before we got the part installed. So what we did, you know, at night we borrowed a neighbor's tractor and did our tillage at night and planted our own that tractor. So we were able to make it through. But granted, we probably weren't a large enough farmer to have the dealer come out right away. But our members are just asking for the opportunity to be able to look at some of the stuff. And granted, you know, some of the stuff is just so technical. They're not everybody's going to be able to want to do it. But just for the simple fixes that are out there that could keep you rolling would, you know, be very much appreciated. You know, the spring and the fall, we're under a heavy time crunch to get our crop planted and then harvested. And the dealers, they can't – that's when they get their heavy load of calls to fix equipment. And they can't hire enough technicians to have, I mean, it's not practical for them to double their load of technicians for those two seasons and the rest of the time just having them not doing anything. So we think this would provide an opportunity. We just, you know, we're not looking at modifying the equipment. You know, I still remember back in the old 806 days, there was a local mechanic named Hank. He'd crank on the pump, and the, you know, the exhaust would come out just blacker and smoke, and that's, you know, what a few farmers wanted. That, but nobody's asking for that now. The equipment costs too much money now to do that. We're just asking for the basic right to have a chance to look at it and do some repair if possible. I will never use it, but, you know, there's people, grandchildren that are out there, maybe, you know, they can go to tech school and come back on the farm, and maybe they could, you know, maybe they would have the opportunity to do this. So, and it's also the opportunity of starting new businesses around the state. There are some areas of the state where there's a lot of distance between dealerships, and you know, dealerships do a very good job. They do the best they can. You know, they have a chain of stores, maybe five, six, whatever it is, and you know, but every one of them stores won't, they have a part stocked within their system, so sometimes you have to drive significant ways to get that part. And you might still have to do that, but it would provide an opportunity to start small businesses around the state, too, possibly, to work on, say, a John Deere or a Case tractor, and which would be good for greater Minnesota, another opportunity to provide jobs.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Wordish. Terry Michaleski.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Terry Michaleski. I'm a shareholder in a John Deere dealership in southeast Minnesota. We have 8 locations and 170 employees. And I have a couple points germane to the legality of this bill. Manufacturers of farm, construction, and forestry equipment generally sell products through independently owned dealerships such as mine. Based upon legal dealer agreements, mandating that a manufacturer now sells documentation, tools, and parts directly to independent repair providers, as the bill would have them do, puts the manufacturer in direct violation of the contract they have with distributors themselves. On the other hand, requiring dealers like ourselves to sell these parts and or goods at cost equates to an impairment of the manufacturer's contract with the distributors such as myself. Under either scenario, this bill violates the impairment of contracts provision in the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10. Also, dealers as myself contract with the manufacturers for the right to distribute their equipment and provide warranty repairs and non-warranty services. As part of this agreement, we invest heavily in tooling, training, parts, and inventories so that we can effectively support our customers. In fact, just last year, SEMA alone spent over $80,000 in parts and service training alone. In return for these investments, we are able to purchase parts at wholesale prices and then resell them to the customer at reasonable market value, which, of course, takes into account the sizable investments we have made. Requiring dealers to sell goods at cost is a taking in violation of the U.S. Fifth Amendment Clause, which prohibits the government from taking private property for public use without just compensation. Furthermore, mandating that manufacturers allow independent repair providers access to OEM software without the protection of the dealer agreements, confidentiality clauses, and agreed-upon terms of use that they have with the dealer, such as myself, is a forced transfer of intellectual property. This is a violation of the Theft of Trade Secrets Clarification Act of 2012, which amends the Economic Espionage Act of 1996. Yesterday I spoke to a farmer customer who he actually has the tools that the previous testifier is asking for. These tools are available. You just got to go buy them. They have virtually the same capacities that our technicians use to fix these tractors, except it doesn't give them access to embedded coding. Why is this important? According to the farmer I talked to, he said, you don't want customers or any untrained person to have access to this embedded coding. Now, I'm going to guess a lot of you haven't been in a tractor lately, so I'm going to kind of break it down for you.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mr. Michaleski, if, you know, we have limited time on this bill, so if you can just state your reasons.
Okay,
I think you got into those, but, you know, we don't have.
So if a customer goes in and changes the embedded coding on our self-driving tractors, and they crash into somebody else, who's liable for that? If they change the embedded coating to bypass the EPA's mandated regulations and the engine is damaged or damaged beyond repair or damaged at all, who is liable for that? There's no digital footprint with these mechanisms. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michaleski. That's basic contributory negligence. If I go in and screw around with the coating and then I crash the tractor, that's contributory negligence and I can't recover. So, any other testifiers? Amos Briggs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Amos Briggs from Lockridge Grindle Now, and here today on behalf of the Minnesota South Dakota Equipment Dealers Association. I think Terry hit many of the concerns around legal ramifications in a scenario where this were to become law in Minnesota, so I will not review those. Just here to state that on behalf of the equipment dealers of Minnesota, we oppose House File 1138 and appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Briggs. Tim Schaefer. Please, as soon as possible, introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'll keep my statement brief. I want to thank Representative Fisher for bringing that bill to committee and working with us on it, and I want to thank all the folks who are part of this coalition who couldn't be here today. Just want to speak briefly to some of the legal questions. I think it's generally understood that contracts need to follow the law and contracts can be modified. So if this goes forward, contracts should reflect the fact that this is the law of the land. There is no affordability clause in this bill, so nothing requires the manufacturers to sell at a particular price, only at fair and reasonable terms. And finally, last year, the U.S. Copyright Office ruled that repair is a legal act that does not violate copyright. So there is a very well fleshed out body of law that says that repair is a protected act. This bill is just about getting people the things they need to actually make those repairs. So, yeah, with that said, I'm happy to take any questions that you have about the liability issues as well, but I don't want to take up too much more of the time.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Tony Quillis.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, and following your lead, I will be brief and try and stay to the purview of this committee. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm representing two entities here today, the Consumer Technologies Association and the Computer Technology Industry Association, better known as CompTIA. And there's a couple of points that we would like to touch on, Mr. Chairman, and the first one would be the definition of fair and reasonable terms. We think that my definition of that and your definition of that, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure are different, but we have some concerns about the fair and reasonable terms, Mr. Chairman. Second, there is some exemptions for trade secrets, Mr. Chairman, but if you look at the language, it says except as necessary to provide documentation, parts, tools on fair and reasonable terms. If you cross back the documentation, that includes manuals, diagrams, reporting outputs, and service source codes, and any other similar information. So there is concerns there that we are going to have to, for free, provide proprietary information. Mr. Chairman, there is a new statute created under 325E.72. 325E is trade practices, and 325F is consumer protection, which usually is enforced under the Department of Commerce for the most part. This would go through and have the enforcement go through the Attorney General under the restraint of trade, and specifically the deceptive trade practices, which is concerning to our folks, Mr. Chairman. And then finally, under an authorized repair dealer, under those terms and contracts, we are able to control and have data privacy and security concerns addressed in those authorized repair provider contracts. And we're concerned that if we have to go and cough up all of our documentation that I had referenced earlier to go through, that we are to independent repair providers, that there are data privacy and security concerns, Mr. Chairman. With that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Quillis. Anyone else in the audience? Okay, one, two. Anyone else raise your hand who wants to come down and be heard on this? That's a really low hand there. Just get it up there. Be proud. Be proud. Loud and proud. Okay. Mr. Patrick, welcome to committee.
Mr. Chair, members, Bobby Patrick. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Medical Alley Association. I just want to come down and briefly thank Representative Fisher for working with us on the language around the amendment you just adopted. It was addressed the concerns that we had and limits it to only products that are manufactured for use in a medical setting. So that's all, and just keep my comments brief. Thank
Excellent.
You, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Patrick. Come on down. State your name for the record. Begin your testimony.
My name is Piper Clay. I am a high school student in St. Paul, and I do repair in my school. Like many organizations and schools, we really rely on technology that keeps our school running. And I go to a small school, so we can't afford to replace things when they break. So I run my school's tech team, where I fix a lot of the things, but I don't have access to the things that we need to fix, the materials and tools. And so this is why this is so important to me and other organizations and schools, is because by having the access to the correct tools and parts, then we can keep fixing things instead of replacing them and change the culture away from throwing things away to repairing things.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your testimony appearing in front of the committee. Are there any questions that members of the committee have for testifiers? Chair Johnson.
Scott. Chair Lash, I guess probably the first testifier that we had, the person.
Jennifer Larson. Go ahead and ask your question. What's this coming?
One thing I'm wondering, a lot of this technology and the stuff that they're after in this bill that provided, besides being some of it proprietary, it affects the warranties. I'm just wondering if these companies have to give this information out, the person doing the repair is not authorized to repair service. Who's covering the warranty information if that $500,000 tractor is destroyed because of the improper repairs done?
Jennifer, you can answer that, but most of these warranties are void if you screw around with it. Go ahead, Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For my company, I warranty my own equipment. So most of what we buy back from large, if a Fortune 500 company is refreshing, I buy their equipment back, break it down, rebuild it, and then I warranty it myself. So that's what most of the companies in the industry do, is my understanding.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members, but this isn't what this bill does. The way this bill is written, it takes brand new equipment, it malfunctions, instead of bringing it to an authorized dealer, somebody could open it up and void the warranty, and that could be very costly to the individual. So I have a lot of concerns on this bill.
Well, did you want to respond to that, Ms. Larson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be up to the individual and the free market to take it where he wants.
Okay. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fisher, for bringing this bill about. I just wanted to say that repair is an extremely lucrative industry, and as a result, I believe it's important for us to ensure that there are not repair monopolies. As it pertains particularly to electronic waste and to more particularly equipment that has become more digitized, more electronic in terms of agricultural production, I think it's essential in order to preserve the livelihood of many people who are the backbone of our country and the backbone of our agricultural system, that the tradition of being able to repair their equipment is maintained in the digital age. So I just wanted to add that input, and I wanted to thank you again.
Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this reminds me of the automobile manufacturers versus the dealers a little bit. And the thing I guess that most concerns me is the issue of contracts and the contracts that John Deere would have with a dealer and that sort of thing. So that is a really a big concern for me. And that's a comment, but I do have one question, and that would be to the bill author. And I noticed that in the bill, it brings attention to the Attorney General, that statute. And the Attorney General can already enforce consumer protection, so I'm just wondering why it was necessary to add specific authority in this bill.
Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. Just want to make sure that it was clearly spelled out so that people would know which way to go on it. Is, while sometimes things are outlined in different sections of law, we want to make sure it was clear here so people would have that clear option.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like we're doing an awful lot of that when it's already under the purview of the Attorney General's Office for Consumer Protection. It seems like I've seen this a couple of times this year, and I'm just wondering why the special treatment, but thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative Carlson is first. Go ahead, Representative Carlson.
Oh, that's okay. I can wait until later.
Representative,
I have some comment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it relates specifically to that section, too. This is on page 4, line 4.7 through 4.9. To the bill author, if you could just explain what additional authority are you giving to the Attorney General, if any, and I see that you've specifically spelled it out, but is there any additional authority that you're giving that he doesn't already have? You could just be very clear about that.
Representative Fisher.
I can help phone a friend on that.
Tim Schaefer.
Hi. My reading is that does not give the Attorney General any additional authority. It just refers to the statute for enforcement that already exists.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we strike this language, it is a kind of a moot point because he already has authority over this?
It's directing... Mr. Chair, apologies. My understanding is it's directing the proper channel for enforcement, not creating a new channel for enforcement. So it's saying under this statute, this is where we should be enforcing violations of the law.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you didn't really answer the question. So if we don't have this in there, would the Attorney General still have authority, as he does now, over this section of law, or is this a new authority that you're now giving to the Attorney General?
My understanding is that it is it's just clarification. So striking it would make things less clear, and I don't think would improve the bill, but it would not remove his authority.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not sure that makes the bill any better. If he already has authority, then he already has authority. So to me, it just makes it more confusing to have it in, as if he now has more authority than he had before over an area where he didn't have before. Normally, we would put something in statute to say, you know, this is a new authority, this is a new section that you're now over. So to me, it actually makes the bill more confusing. So I just want to point that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the privilege of hearing this bill in Commerce, so this is kind of the second round for me. And you know, at the time, kind of referred to this as the can-do bill. I'm really intrigued by this approach, and did offer to work with Representative Fisher on this as it moves forward. I am sensitive to the opposition towards this, especially from the commentary that's brought forth by the dealers, and I think some of this other concerns can be addressed through this. This bill is good for the environment. This bill is good for consumers. This bill is good for small businesses. The access to free market, I think, was stressed, and that's something I clearly support. And then this, of course, it protects local jobs. So there's a lot in this bill to be excited about. It is new. I think we heard in Commerce that while there are bills throughout the country, no one has adopted this type of legislation yet. So I think it is still in its kind of infancy. But I do kind of pledge to continue to work on this with the bill author and hope to engage others as this conversation continues. I have received numerous emails from different groups, too, so I am taking all that into consideration. And, I think it was stated earlier, too, you know, this is the second R of the three R's of recycling: reduce, reuse, and recycle. So, I mean, in this modern digital age, I think this really kind of gets at the core of what the future of our state economy can look like. So look forward to continuing on with the work.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a couple questions for the bill author. And the first is, as I'm looking at lines 4.1 through 4.6, it reads, for equipment that contains I'm sorry, let me, that's the wrong line. The I'm looking at line 2.1 through 2.3. So digital equipment or equipment means any product that depends for its functioning in whole or in part on digital electronics embedded in or attached to the product. And so that's my understanding. That's pretty much every device, not every, but the vast majority of products in our modern day have some kind of a chip that if you pull it out, it's not going to function, which means it would qualify to be dependent in whole or in part on a particular component. So almost every piece of equipment in every industry would be in scope in this bill, as I'm reading this, if I'm correct. So that being the case, why did we, or why did you, exclude two industries per subdivision six? Why were the motor vehicle equipment manufacturers and the medical device manufacturers specifically excluded when all other industries then are included?
Who's got two? Representative Fisher, right?
Mr. Chair. Phone a friend.
Yeah. Apologies. Mr. Chair, the automotive industry is excluded because the Massachusetts bill that we mentioned earlier, which is, I believe, the Massachusetts Right to Repair Initiative, resulted in a memorandum of understanding that covers the entire national market. So we didn't want this bill to interfere with that memorandum of understanding since it was a pretty well negotiated and fair agreement between the parties concerned. For medical equipment, there were concerns about people being able to fix their own medical devices, especially ones that have, are internal, and so we wanted to avoid the possibility of that happening. I think that with the other equipment mentioned, say farm equipment, there are pretty clear precedent in Minnesota law that say people need to inspect equipment like that before they sell it, and you also have a particularly higher obligation to do a good job with things that have dangerous implications. So I think that's well addressed by precedent under Minnesota law.
Okay, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So part of my concern then when we go to lines 4.1 through 4.6, which reads, for equipment that contains an electronic security lock or other security-related function, the OEM must make available to the owner and to the independent repair providers, et cetera, et cetera. So there are many technologies or equipment that's out there in the universe of equipment that exists in our day-to-day lives that contain a security lock to prevent access. And if these dealers, and I'm thinking everything from stoplights to everything that's outside of equipment to this to vehicles and medical device, if these are made available to the owners of the equipment, I think that there are many unintended consequences is all I'm putting forward. But then when I'm thinking about that same section, 4.1 through 4.6, mobile phones, for example, and Representative Johnson brought it up earlier, so you a consumer can purchase a brand new piece of equipment. I'll just use a mobile phone, for example, so it's brand new. And it's going to have a warranty to some degree, 1 year, 3 year, whatever it is. And you've probably heard the term bricking your phone. And so when you try to access the phone to make modifications to it that is not authorized, it'll brick the phone. And so when I'm reading this, it sounds like this will make tools available to access parts of a phone. And in the case of it's a brand new phone still covered by warranty, if there are modifications made to it because they have to make the electronic lock available to be able to open it and access it, that changes can be made that would potentially have an impact on the function of the equipment that then now would impact the warranty feature of it that the vendor would still be responsible then for covering warranty. So I guess
I don't think that if you void the warranty, the vendor is responsible for covering the warranty. But whatever the case,
no, Mr. Chair, just clarity then. What I'm referring to is if security locks are made available, so an owner of equipment can now get into and access parts of equipment that contain electronic modules, make modifications to them. How is the owner, how is the vendor supposed to know that a change had a negative impact to the device and that they must now, they're on the hook for satisfying the warranty requirements when the owner of it made changes that the vendor shouldn't be responsible for but can't prove.
Okay, well, I don't know.
Right, so you...
If you have a source code, you can see the source code is different. But if you want to answer, go ahead, take a shot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kyle Lepton. I'm with CPR, Cell Phone Repair. We have 13 shops in town. Right. As far as if you came in with the device today, we do not need your password. We can fix the device with hardware replacements, and simply you would enter your password to test it with us in the shop. It's not something we need to get internal. It's just simply access to the tools to be able to remove stuff cosmetically perfectly and reassemble perfectly. We'd like the repairs to be as close to OEM as possible, if not OEM.
Okay. All right. Any other questions regarding... Oh, Chair Johnson.
Chair Lash, I'm just sitting here listening. It brought up some more issues that and some serious concerns because it involves anything with digital and computerized. We have a lot of equipment out there, CNC machines in the machine shop industry. We have electronics everywhere. Now take a CNC shop. A guy, instead of the machining is not functioning. So they, instead of calling the actual company, they call Joe Repairman down the street. He comes in, does something, gets it working because the codes were available. Now they start using that machine again, and the operator's arm is cut off. Who's liable? Is that Joe Repairman down the street have the insurance for that? Or is it going to be a issue where the lawsuit's going after the company and the machine, although they had nothing to do with it? This bill has a lot of problems. I think it needs to go back from the beginning and start over.
Okay. Representative Lucero, you had a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just addressing some of the comments that I've heard from other committee members as well, such as it's pro-jobs, pro-environment, pro-consumer, and I'll just make my thoughts very clear, is that this is not a black or white issue. There's a lot of gray in here. And so I don't think some of these comments we're hearing, it's quite that clear cut. And just one example how it may not be as pro-consumer as it's being put out there, let's use printers, for example. So when you think of printer manufacturers, sometimes you can buy a printer for super cheap, $49.99, $99.99. The printer manufacturer is not making their money on the printer, but they then make their money on, in the case of inkjet, for example, when an inkjet cartridge costs $59.99. So sometimes what these printer manufacturers have done to recoup some of their R&D, millions of dollars that go into producing these equipment for the benefit of society, they try to make the ink cartridge so that it is you can't use a third-party ink cartridge for it, so that when you try to insert a third-party ink cartridge, it'll recognize it's not HP's, for example. And so when I'm reading this language, getting back to my security lock, I think there's unintended consequences since the verbiage I brought up, it's the universe of all electronics that are dependent and wholly in part on this. There is a large gray area and unintended consequences that it may not, there's a disincentive now for equipment manufacturers, if they can't recover their costs, that they it may not be as pro-consumer because less products would be developed. So I'm just putting it out there for the benefit of members to consider. It's just not as clear-cut. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
They can recover their costs if they sell the printer for the accurate price and they sell the ink cartridge for the accurate price of what it costs to produce. I guarantee you it does not cost $60 or $100 to produce one of those ink cartridges. It's the OEMs gaming the system to their benefit so they can bleed you out over a longer period of time. This bill seeks to level the playing field, I think. I think you're right that it's a little bit more of a gray area than it's being presented. However, I think it's grayer than you're presenting as well, too, because it's gamed by the OEMs. Any close... Representative Considine.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Hadn't planned to comment, but we've watched this for decades now. I remember the first time I saw it was the Corvette, where you could no longer change the spark plugs in the Corvette in the 70s because you had to have a special tool that only GM had. And we have put out thousands of small business have been put out of business because of specialized things that were done deliberately, like the tool that you needed to change one spark plug. You could get the other seven, but you couldn't get the eighth. And this has been a deliberate march towards consolidating and putting small business people out of business. And thank you, Representative Fisher, for bringing forward this bill.
Representative Fisher, closing comments.
Thank you. Basically, I want to say right now I can take my car most places to get it fixed. I should be able to do the same with my computer or phone. I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. The chair renews his motion that House file. Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Representative Noor moved the motion that House file 1138 as amended be placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails here on the general register. Thank you, Representative Fisher and testifiers. Members, tonight we're going to be back for House File 1151, Representative Hassan, House File 804, that's mine, that's the Data Practices Commission. I got a House File 2004, unredacted information of the parties, and House File 262, Representative Dean. Tomorrow, there will be gestational carrier contracts, child foster care. Second. Thank you. Human Services, Policy Provisions, and Children and Family Services, and Industrial Hemp. So make sure you're here for this tomorrow so you can hear Industrial Hemp. Any other business before the committee? Representative O'Neill?
Mr. Chair, did you say when and where we're meeting tonight?
It's 5 p.m. right here.
Yeah,
and by the way, all the other junior chairs soaked up the hearing rooms for Friday, so if we have to meet on Friday, it's going to be at 5 p.m. too. Really excited about that. Okay, there being no other business before the committee, we're in recess. We're in recess. Okay. Judiciary Committee is back in session. First bill we have up on the calendar after our recess is House File 1511. Representative Hassan, are you ready to roll? This is eviction case court files, discretionary and mandatory expungements eligibility expanded. So Representative Hassan moves that her own bill be recommended to be placed on the general register. You have an author's amendment, the A2.
Yes.
Does everyone have a copy of the amendment? Is there any discussion on it? This is just to get. Oh, where'd you go? This is just to.
You gotta grab the amendment.
You got your stuff. This is just to get your bill in the shape that you want. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion passes 1-0. Representative Hassan, to your bill as amended. And also, we have Larry McDonough, pro bono counsel for Dorsey and Whitney. I don't know why anyone would be pro bono counsel for Dorsey Wayne. They already have plenty of lawyers, and I'd make them pay because they got the money to pay. I'm just kidding. I know what it means. But if you can go ahead and do you want to go ahead and take it away for Hassan
yes.
first?
Okay, yes,
go ahead.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House File 1511 is relating to housing, expanding for eligibility of discretionary and mandatory expungement. From the year 2015 to 2017, there were at least 13,000 evictions filed against Minnesotans per year. An unlawful detainer, rightly or wrongly filed, stays on, follows tenants for at least 7 years, making it nearly impossible for them to find quality and affordable housing. What this bill does is What it does is to make sure that evictions wouldn't show up before the judge makes a final ruling. This will give tenants the due process, innocent until proven guilt, that our Constitution gives us. And it would allow mandatory expungement for a case where a landlord is without basis, or if the defendant prevailed, or if the case is dismissed. I am not an expert on housing or a legal. So I have a testifier here with me, and he'll be able to explain it more.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee. Mr. McDonough, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, good evening, Chair and members. My name is Larry McDonough. I am pro bono counsel at Dorsey & Whitney. I'm helping the firm spend its money. So I direct a free legal program within the firm, and that our clients include low-income tenants, but also low-income landlords and small nonprofit landlords. I myself have been a specialist in landlord-tenant law for about 35 years, and I've assisted over 10,000 firm landlords and tenants in my practice. And I'm also a professor of landlord-tenant law. One of my former students is a lobbyist for the Multi-Housing Association. So as the representative mentioned, the bill is to expand the opportunities for expungement of eviction files. Right now, under Statute 484.014, expungement is actually quite limited. Mandatory expungement is limited to really just a couple of issues in mortgage foreclosure, contract for deed evictions. And discretionary expungement is limited to cases in which a tenant can show that the landlord's case had something wrong with it. And so the effect of that is really to allow eviction records to be public for a long, long time. Many thousands of evictions stay on the records for many years, and it's very difficult for tenants years later to come back and prove what might have been wrong in the landlord's case in the first place. A lot of landlords use evictions as kind of a flag to say, well, I'm not going to interview this person, I'll just kind of clear the eviction tenants off of my kind of plate and look at other tenants. And I can also speak from the role as a landlord. I've been a landlord off and on myself for the last 30 years. I'm not presently a landlord. I was last landlord about 3 years ago. Having evictions, expungements being as limited as they are has led to, I believe, increase in homelessness and shelter usage and in housing instability. And just to give an example under the current statute, I had a case a few years back with a couple of young women who had been students at Cold Spring High School. And some of you may remember that there was a school shooting at Cold Spring High School back in the early 2000s. And both of these gals knew one of the students who had died. And they were going back and forth to Cold Spring. They were U of M students at the time. They were going back and forth to Cold Spring, and each thought the other had paid the rent, and neither had paid the rent. And the landlord knew that they were pretty together, and so when the landlord didn't get the rent, the landlord filed an eviction case. Well, when they came back, they realized what the problem was. They worked out a settlement with the landlord. They paid the landlord all the rent, all the costs, all the filing fees and everything, and they stayed for the remainder of their lease and moved out at the end of the school year. They didn't even know they had an eviction on their record. When they found out, they filed for an expungement, and that expungement was denied under the statute, and probably properly denied because there wasn't anything the landlord had done wrong with that case. And so under the statute at the time, expungement wasn't available. Now, I was teaching at a clinic at the time. We appealed that, and we convinced the judge that it was within the judge's inherent authority to expunge that case, and so then the judge did. So they were served by that. But the statute at that time was way too limited to really assist these women who, you know, they made a mistake, but they shouldn't have had that following them around for years. So what the proposal would do is to expand expungement. It would expand the categories of mandatory expungement from those two pretty narrow categories in mortgage foreclosure right now to include where the defendants prevailed on the merits, if the case has been dismissed, the parties have agreed to expungement, if the case settles and the tenant satisfies the settlement, or if the court finds that the eviction is at least 3 years old. And it changes discretionary expungement to allow the court to look at whether the eviction is a good predictor of what tenant conduct might be right now. And I'd have to say, from a former landlord's perspective, that was always the more important issue to me, is there something in the tenant's history that tells me what the tenant's going to be like now? As a landlord, I want tenants to pay the rent and to follow the rules, not damage anything, not bug their neighbors. And if the eviction case, so let's say there's under this proposal, let's say there's an eviction case for like and the tenant lost that case and there's loud behavior that was bugging other tenants, That's something I would want to know about as a landlord, and that's something that would not be shielded from this unless the case was fairly old. The last thing the bill would provide is a period of privacy in eviction cases until there's a final decision on the merits, and that's based on a paradigm in California. I can certainly answer questions about this and give you more detail on this, but I thought I would just run through what the bill does to the existing statute.
Thank you, Mr. McDonough. Questions for Mr. McDonough? Representative Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on line 1.11 to 1.12, you just alluded to that the cases or the finding now from the court is, number one, the eviction court case file is no longer a reasonable predictor of future tenant behavior. Can you give some examples as to how would the court determine that? How is the court going to know what the future behavior is going to be?
Mr. McDonough.
Yes, member and the chair. It is a subjective standard. There are a lot of things in the law that are subjective. So in my area of practice, if the landlord wants to evict a tenant for breach of lease, they have to prove it's a material breach of lease. Well, materiality ends up being kind of a subjective standard based on the events at the time. Something that may be a minor violation of the lease might not be material. Something that's pretty serious, like drug dealing in the property, would. So that would be, it's a little bit hard to predict, but part of the issue here with discretionary expungement is to give the judge or the referee some ability to look at the circumstances. So let's say this is an eviction, let's say there's an eviction case for non-payment of rent, and it looks like, and that was like from just a few months ago, and there isn't anything that the tenant has said to indicate that their life has changed at all, I could see the court saying, I'm not going to expunge this because a future landlord needs to know that you had this eviction case for non-payment of rent from like 5 months ago and you didn't have any justifying circumstances, as opposed to the case that I just mentioned with the two women from Cold Spring. I think a judge in that case could look at that and say, well, that seems like a fairly unique circumstance, what was going on there. That does not look predictive of your future behavior since you satisfied that case, so I am going to expunge that one. So it is a subjective standard, but subjectivity allows judicial officers to look at kind of the mitigating factors that either mitigate in favor of expungement or against it.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So most of the examples you gave were things that had already happened in the past. So you can go back and look and say, yes, this happened or that happened, or there was a breach of contract, there was a breach of the lease. But that, are you saying now that the judge will look at all of that and predict what they're going to be in the future? I just find this a little bit troubling and it's got to be difficult for a judge to say, well, this is now going to be the future behavior, so that's how I'm going to rule. I'm just not clear how a judge would determine that, I guess. Maybe because kind of the examples you gave were looking back as opposed to looking forward. So can you maybe just try again? I'm not quite sure I understand you.
Give it another try, Mr. McDonough.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think this the proposal is not to get the court to predict the future, but to allow the court to look at the past to try to figure out if that past is helpful in determining future conduct. So I'm not trying to dance on words. What I do is, when I did as a landlord, is let's say you had some non-payment of rent in your past. As a prospective landlord, I'd then want to ask you, well, what was going on at that time and what's going on now? And maybe you tell me that I was in between jobs at that time and that's why I got behind the rent, but now my job is current and I don't have any trouble with the rent. And in fact, with the landlord that I have right now, I've got a good record and a good track record. And so essentially what this would allow the court to do is to do what I just did, looking at the tenants, what was going on at the tenant at the time of the eviction case, and look at what the tenant has to say about what's going on in his or her life now to see if this eviction case should still follow that tenant around.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I could see that for a landlord because they're taking quite a bit of risk. they are, you know, a bad tenant can come in and really destroy it. My parents used to rent out all the time, and out of the several businesses that they owned, one of them was rentals. And so as a child, I got to see the aftermath of bad renters, where they would literally rip the wiring out of the walls, and they would take, you know, they would destroy carpeting, and it was thousands and thousands of dollars of remodel that was necessary. So, yes, the landlord has got a great, they have to be very cautious because they could be out a lot of money. But now we're talking about the court making that decision. And I don't know, I just have some issues about predicting future behavior as a basis for expungement. I would be very cautious. I would be very cautious in using this language as a basis for expungement. I understand with a landlord because they have huge investments, but for a basis for expungement, I just have really a lot of concern about that.
Thank you. Any other Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The language that's on 1.12 regarding the reasonable predictor of future tenant behavior, is that found anywhere else in law that you know of? To the testifier, Mr. Chair.
Mr. McDonough.
Representative and Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of that language being used in other places. It kind of comes from the concept, at least my concept as a former landlord, is that's what I was looking at when I would be screening tenants. And it would be to figure out, because what I think any landlord is going to try to figure out is what is future conduct going to be based on past history. And it seemed like this would be a good kind of paradigm for a judge to do, again, in discretionary expungement, because the judge doesn't have to expunge. And the point is, an expungement in our court system is not a commonplace thing. We have generally public records. So the idea is, why should the judge allow this record to be expunged if it's not a mandatory expungement? And so this seemed like good language to be added. And it's partially to do with the limitations of the current statute. Right now, the current statute really says, judge, look at whether the landlord did anything wrong in this eviction case from 3 years ago, and not really assess whether it has any indication to a future landlord as to whether this tenant would be problematic or not. So we believe this is actually giving the judiciary some tools to kind of better analyze expungements than the tools they have right now.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, circumstances, even if somebody had a had an unlawful detainer 3 years prior, that could have been, you know, maybe they were unable to pay. But now they're applying with me, Landlord B, and I can't see that. But they may have new circumstances. Maybe they have a new live-in boyfriend or girlfriend that is going to cause trouble that I don't know about. But there might be other indications by looking at both the past history of both of those people that are going to give me an indicator of maybe what's to come. And I think this is asking judges to be somewhat clairvoyant by trying to predict what the future behavior of a tenant might be. And when I'm also a landlord, and when we look at an application, the unlawful detainers matter, and the reason for the unlawful detainers matter. And as Representative O'Neill said, you know, we've had tenants that have caused tens of thousands of dollars in damages to our property, and so we want to be extremely careful, and we want to know as much information as we can to cover our own rear ends and keep from having an expense like that. And I will say too that on a number of occasions, if we take somebody to court for an unlawful detainer for a non-payment, we want to work it out with them because it's expensive for us, as you know, if you've been a landlord, to have a turnover. So I think most landlords are probably already acting in good faith because they don't want to have that turnover. But there are other reasons for eviction other than just non-payment of rent. And the breaking of the lease is more than just non-payment. It's you have somebody living there that's not on the lease. You're not taking care of the property. All sorts of things. I just think that a landlord should have as much information as possible when making that really, really important decision. And so I think this language is really problematic for me. Thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions, but I guess the first would be for you. Since we are on line 1.11 talking about the court, is there a fiscal note that you're aware of tied to this because of the potential increase in court activity?
Hey, can you turn that flashlight off there? It's kind of blinding me. So, I don't know, research, is there a fiscal note on this?
Mr. Chair, this is not a bill that I requested a fiscal note on because I did not anticipate it would generate enough. I can request a fiscal note. However, it's rare that the court assumes that something will drive so much business into the court that they actually request additional judges or staff. So I have conversations with them from time to time. This is not one that I believed would, but I can request one if the committee wants one.
The committee doesn't want one. I don't necessarily think it would. Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I was asking that is the bill author's opening comments worth, was it $13,000 per year?
$13,000 per year for 2015 through 2017.
For eviction.
Okay, so over $10,000, well over $10,000. And then we're asking the court with this new, and then as we also heard in the questioning, that there is nowhere in statute, at least people are immediately aware of the court using this standard. So we don't know what the effort will be for the court to have to take on this new standard. But then as we heard from the testifier, that there clearly is an interest in using past behavior as a predictor of future behavior. Right, it's clearly recognized that's important. But what this bill is seeking to do is move that from present law, which allows the landlord, the property manager, the property owner from engaging in that activity, subjective as was admittedly the case, and moving that to the courts. And I'm not sure that that's in the best interest of the property owner who has the risk in accepting somebody to lease their property. I think that would be better left where it is rather than allowing the court to decide that, but allow the landlords. So just a comment on that, Mr. Chair. Matt. But then the next question, or comment perhaps, is right now if I were to draw the committee members' attention to line 2.7 and 2.8, that if the court finds an eviction was ordered at least 3 years prior to the date the expungement was filed. So my understanding is that this would be all evictions would be dropped off the record after 3 years. So, Mr. Harris, can that be confirmed?
We took that out with the A19 amendment. Page 2, line 7 was deleted.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We only did the A2.
No, it wasn't. Okay, that was my CA's fault then. I blame her for everything. Of course, she gets the credit for everything, though, too. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. So the fact that it hasn't been removed yet is still in there, and we don't know if it's going to the amendment will be adopted or not. So all evictions will be removed after 3 years. Now, I am a landlord myself as well, and I have two-year leases, and 3 years just doesn't seem like enough time. So I look at some of the other activity related to behavior that stays on the record. So I first looked up foreclosures. Foreclosures are on a person's record for 7 years, and they can bring down your credit. I looked up bankruptcy. Chapter 13 bankruptcies are on there for 7 years. Chapter 7 bankruptcies are on there for 10 years. And then I looked up a missed payment or delinquency of a credit card, and those are on there for 7 years. And so these other behaviors that a person that can be a predictor of somebody's credit worthiness or ability to pay in the future is well beyond 3 years. So I have a concern with limiting it to 3 years because that does not give the landlord the visibility into making a better decision. So, Mr. Chair, then I look at the eviction process, and if somebody is being evicted, maybe I'll ask this question. Generally speaking, to the testifier, could you tell us what is the average time that it takes to complete an eviction process? And specifically, I'm looking at line, where is it? Line 2.13, an eviction action is not accessible to the public until the court enters a final judgment. So generally speaking, what is an average amount of time that takes?
Mr. McDonough.
Representative, Mr. Chair, you've raised three different things. I'll start with the third one last. So the amount of time, I can't tell you statistically what an average is, but I can tell you from having done 10,000 cases basically how it works. So I'd say the short end of an eviction case would be about 2 weeks. I'd say that the more average time for an eviction case is probably about 3 weeks. There certainly are cases that get very complex, more in the commercial area, that can litigate for, you know, perhaps several months. That is really uncommon in the residential setting. So I would say you're kind of looking in the 2 to 3 week range. Now, eviction cases, when they're, it depends a little bit on then what happens. I mean, if you have an eviction case and tenant doesn't show and the landlord gets an immediate writ, that could probably be like a 2 week case. If the case settles and it gets resolved right away, that's probably a 2 week case. If a case gets scheduled for a trial, then that probably makes it more into maybe a 3 week case or maybe a little bit later depending on the scheduling. In terms of the amount of time that it takes a landlord to finish off an eviction case, let's say the tenant doesn't show but also doesn't move, so the landlord then has to utilize the sheriff to make the tenant move out and take care of the property, that throws about another week on to the end of the process. So, again, I would say the short range, probably 2 weeks, probably the average is probably 3 weeks. It could extend into 4 weeks, you know, if you have to utilize the sheriff and stuff. And going back to the last 2 points, in terms of the three-year time frame, a couple things to keep in mind. One is that tenant screening agencies can only report these cases for 7 years under federal law, but there isn't any limitation on how long they stay in the court's database. I did an expungement case a few months ago of a case that was back from 2000, and the court file didn't even, the physical file didn't even exist anymore. And so it was really hard to, and the tenant really didn't remember much about it. The landlord didn't come and respond. The court did expunge it in its inherent authority, but it was really hard to know what was going on with that case. And part of that has to do with the court has, you know, they're kind of rules and statutes for everything, right? There is a set of rules on how long courts recommend that files remain. And the court rule recommendation for eviction cases is actually 1 year. So there are some court systems that are actually destroying the physical files at that point. Some aren't. It's just a recommendation. And that's why you do run into situations where there might be an eviction case that's a few years old and the physical file actually doesn't exist anymore, but there's still that imprint out there. And the last thing, going back to your first point about taking kind of away from landlords the ability to kind of look at past conduct and future conduct. This proposal doesn't require landlords to rent to anybody and doesn't take any authority away from landlords to deny or to rent to people. It does limit the availability of the court's public eviction record within these parameters, right? But as a former landlord, that was certainly something I would look at. But I was a landlord before we had tenant screening agencies and before we had electronic data. I'm old enough to have done that. And I did it the way that I did most recently, which is I would check references and get that information from former landlords, current landlords, tenants, maybe neighbors. And if I got the references and I thought they were fishy, like there were made-up references, I didn't rent to that person. And this statute doesn't take away that ability from landlords at all to do kind of the work that landlords always have done, which is screen.
President Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, by the way, Mr. Walls, did you have an update on your last announcement?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What I said before was incorrect. I did, in fact, request a fiscal note on this bill. fiscal note is not official yet because it has not been signed off on by MMB. However, the courts did respond to the fiscal note and did not request a cost because of this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed, Reverend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you take this away from the ability of a landlord to see that that's occurring, they don't know to ask the question and dig deeper. So you are effectively achieving that because imagine a scenario. So somebody's an eviction process has begun by an existing landlord. If that person chooses to not fight it, it'll be shorter, but if they're going to fight it, it'll be longer. But in either case, that person is going to look for new housing. So they're going to begin to put applications out there for new rental properties by new landlords or property managers. And according to line 2.13, the eviction action is in process. It wouldn't be visible. So as the applications are coming in for somebody who's in the process of being evicted, the new landlord who's received an application won't know to even ask the question. And therefore, you've made it difficult for that landlord. In fact, they don't have a totality of the circumstances, and you're denying that landlord the ability to make a judgment in full scope of what's happening. And so I guess the next question I would have based on the answer is why 3 years when we're seeing that the credit bureaus and bankruptcy, they, based on their experience, decades-long experience, it must have been, according to their algorithms, that the best predictors of somebody's future behavior drops off approximately at the seven-year mark. So if that's what the credit bureaus are doing based on their experience, why 3 years here? Why not 7 years or 10 years? To the bill author, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, Representative Hassan, you want to phone a friend? You can.
I'm phoning a friend.
Go ahead, Mr. McDonald.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative, as a former landlord, I always asked the question whether I saw an eviction record or not. I asked, do you have any evictions against you? Because that's still a question I could ask regardless of expungement. As ask prospective tenant, do you have any evictions on your record? I want to know the name of your present landlord, and I want to talk to that person. And if I get information that's fishy or incomplete, I move on to the next applicant. And so there isn't anything that prevents me from doing what I always did as a landlord, is get as complete information about the tenant as I could. Now, in terms of 3 years versus 7 years versus 10 years versus the 1 year that the court has for its proposed schedule for destroying files, to some extent 3 years is an arbitrary number, just like the seven, just like 10, just like one is. And the seven-year issue related to tenant screening agencies is just based on federal law and under the Fair Credit Reporting Act as to how far you can look back. So any of these numbers is going to be arbitrary. I guess I'd have to say from my experience as a landlord, the more useful information to me was always the more recent information. And if you have non-payment of rent from 5 years ago, that's less important to me as a former landlord than non-payment of rent 6 months ago. That's pretty important to me. The further back in time, the less probative it is, and I think any line that you come up with is going to be an arbitrary one.
Last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I was going to say. So you made the comment that you could. There's nothing preventing a prospective landlord from asking an applicant, do you have any evictions? And they could rightfully say no. If they're in the process of an eviction, but it hasn't completed per line 2.13, they can truthfully say, no, I don't have any eviction against me. And so the prospective landlord is going to be deprived the ability to make a decision based on the totality of the current circumstances. And I'm not sure why the bill author is moving that, because clearly, again, just reiterating, clearly it's agreed upon that that is important information, but you're depriving that from the landlord and moving it up to the court. And that is a huge concern for me as a landlord. And so, Mr. Chair, that wasn't a question, it was more of a comment, but I just hope members of this committee understand that this is one of the things, the courts don't have a horse in the race. The landlord has a large amount of risk, and as Representative Scott mentioned, tens of thousands of dollars can be at stake. And we need to allow the landlords to make the decisions based on the totality of the information that's available, and depriving that is only going to increase the risk. And I, as a landlord, I want the full information because what I do, I got into this business when the Great Recession started. And I had applicant after applicant. In fact, if I can recall correctly, I think at least 90% of my applications were from good people who unfortunately suffered the consequence of losing their home. And in fact, 100% of my tenants at that time had gone through foreclosure or bankruptcy. But I, as a landlord, I allowed them to rent from me. And I did so because I had full knowledge, and I was allowed to ask the questions and give good homes to good people that had suffered an unfortunate circumstance. But to deprive a landlord from that is only going to increase the risk of landlords. And what do landlords do in response to increased risk? They increase their rent. And that increased rent is going to further exacerbate the problem that's been identified in Minnesota of affordable housing shortage. And this bill is going to move us in the opposite direction that I think we should go. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, into the one question for the test by you. You brought up that it takes 2 weeks, 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks to do an eviction process. Can you tell me when that happened? Because I've done many eviction notices, and by that, to physically evict people. I don't know when that happened or how long ago. Because right now, and I just got done looking up all the changes in the statutes, and nothing has changed on that. Right now, before an eviction notice can be filed with the courts, the landlord has to send basically a certified letter saying, if you don't make up your rent, get that taken care of, I'm going to have to start the eviction process. They have to give a week or two notice. I think it's 10 days notice before. I'm telling you what I had to go through in my county to do the paperwork. Then once they don't show up with them to take care of the rent, then the eviction process is started. And the sheriff serves the paper. They have usually 2 weeks from the time for the hearing. And once the hearing is, they have 30 days to move out. And if they don't move out, they file the paperwork again, another hearing in 1 week. And they have 30 days to move out. If they don't move out, they file another paper, and then we show up and actually physically remove them. That can take 6 to 9 months. I've done it 4 times where I physically had to remove somebody. It's not 2-3 weeks. The average might be 2-3 weeks because when the paperwork is filed, the person comes in and takes care of the problem. But for those who don't follow through and they have to go through the full thing, it can take 6 to 9 months. So I want to get that on the record straight. So, and like I say, I've actually served those papers and had to do it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative, where's the list? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking a little bit more about the conversation that we just had and back to the subjectivity of now what the judge will be looking at when you have the language in here about a reasonable predictor of future tenant behavior. And, you know, we talk so much in this committee about consistency across jurisdictions. We talk about fairness and justice and consistency across the jurisdictions. When you're talking about such a subjective standard, I have real concerns with consistency across jurisdictions when you have language that says a reasonable predictor of future behavior. I mean, that's an incredibly subjective, as you pointed out, standard for a judge to look at. So I'm just wondering if you've thought about that and how, you know, if we do this, how are we going to have fairness and equal judgment across all of our jurisdictions in the state of Minnesota?
I'm sorry, Mr. McDonough.
Representative, Mr. Chair. It is subjective. I agree with that. But unless you're going to have laws that kind of dictate an if A, then B kind of analysis, there's always going to be subjectivity. So landlord-tenant law is my area. A big thing in landlord-tenant relationships is habitability, and the statute talks about property being in reasonable repair. Well, that's very subjective. And so reasonable repair of the air conditioner versus reasonable repair of the dishwasher, I think we can all agree that if the ceiling's caving in on you, that's not reasonable repair. But if some things are, if the faucet's leaky, is that reasonable repair? Probably not. And so there's a lot of subjectivity there. As I mentioned earlier, there's subjectivity in what's a material violation of the lease. And so, you know, I think it's difficult to, it's always going to be a balance. The more power you give to a judicial officer to weigh circumstances, the more subjective it's going to be, and the less continuity you're going to have. And the more that laws kind of limit analysis to more kind of black and white factors, you're going to have less subjectivity, but you're also going to have less flexibility to kind of look at the circumstances. So I guess that's the best answer that I have. It is going to have some subjectivity. You might have a judicial officer. I used to practice in Little Falls, so you might have a judicial officer in Morrison County that's going to look at kind of what's a reasonable predictor differently than maybe a referee in Hennepin County. But that would also happen with habitability and lease violation materiality as well.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Wait, who are we on now? Oh, Representative O'Neill, go ahead.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would say that reasonable repair is very different than predicting someone's behavior. I think that a reasonable hurtful person could look at something to say, yes, this has been repaired. That seems like a much smaller stretch with subjectivity than predicting someone's behavior. That is a very, very large stretch of subjectivity. So determining whether or not someone violated a lease, not a very far stretch. I think a reasonable person could decide, yep, they violated the lease. It should be fairly clear. Again, figuring out if someone is going to, what they're going to do in the future is incredibly subjective. So not only does the judge have to use subjectivity, but now you're predicting someone's behavior, which is very different than determining whether or not a repair has been done. So, again, I have great concerns about the consistency across our judicial courts throughout the state, because we're asking judges to do something to predict someone's future behavior, which is very different than the two things that you just stated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Barr. You want to offer your amendments? What do you want to do?
That's what I was.
Okay.
Could we do the A19-128, and then I have a verbal amendment, I guess, I'd like to add on to that one, because it says delete line 7. I think we should probably delete line 8 also, because that's half of the sentence.
That's what I thought.
Thank you.
The chair will accept that oral amendment on line 1.3 of the A19 amendment. Oh, no, I guess line 1.2, which said delete line 7 and 8, right?
Correct.
Huh? Go ahead, Ms. Mullen.
Okay. Chair and members, on the amendment, line 1.1, after House File 1511, it would say the first engrossment.
Oh. Okay, so that's your amendment. All in favor of the oral amendment to the A19 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Go ahead with your amendment as amended, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For most of the reasons that we've already heard, this would give the this would take the expungement out of here and make this a little more consistent with like credit ratings, the credit rating services, bankruptcy laws, and a prospective landlord could actually look at all of the records prior to renting to somebody and take all of the circumstances and ask reasonable questions prior to renting.
Okay. Any other discussion on the A19 amendment as amended?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Representative Hassan, you want to speak to it? Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of committee, this A19 amendment actually defeats the purpose of this bill, and I oppose.
Okay. Chair Liebling.
No,
you're good? Okay. All in favor of the A19 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. No.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Did you have another amendment, Representative Barr?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. The A19-134, and I believe that one should probably also be amended as the House File 115-11, first engrossment.
Okay. The A19, page 2, delete section 3. Do you want to speak to it, Representative Barr?
This basically does, for a lot of the things that have already been articulated by a few of the rest of the members of this committee, it makes all of the records public so that the landlord can make a reasonable decision prior to renting to a prospective tenant.
Excellent. Any other discussion on the A19-134 amendment, right? Did I say that right?
134.
Yeah. 134 amendment. Any other discussion? I assume you oppose, Representative Hassan?
Okay. Yes,
excellent.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other convo? Seeing none, then all in favor of the A19-134 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
No. No. Motion does not prevail. Representative Barr?
I'm good, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. I just want to maybe touch on a little bit of Representative Neal's fairness and justice issue. She mentioned that, and I totally agree with her on that. Also, it sounds like we here have a lot of really good landlords who do their due diligence, who do the right things. But I think that maybe we're missing the point about this particular bill. I'm just curious, in a tenant-landlord relationship, can you, Mr. McDonough, can you tell me generally where the power of the power dynamics, who actually holds the power within that relationship generally?
Okay, was that to Mr.
McDonough?
Mr. McDonough, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative. Well, it's clearly the landlord has more power. The landlord chooses, and most landlords are good landlords. I mean, I unfortunately have to sue the slumlords in my work, and so I see the bad ones there as well. They're definitely bad landlords and bad tenants. But the landlords own the property. They set the rules. The tenants don't set the rules, and the landlords have to follow them. And so there clearly is a power dynamic there.
Follow up, Chair Lesh. So I wonder, in situations of evictions, are there ever a time where a landlord unjustly evicts people? Mr. McDonough.
Mr. McDonough, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. I've been doing this a long time, and I can tell you stories that would make you sad and make you cry of landlords that have had tenants that have to wade through sewage and clean it up on their own, to have ceilings cave in. I had a case where a ceiling caved in, and the landlord's response is, I'm watching the Super Bowl, I'll get back to you. And again, most landlords are good landlords. Some landlords make mistakes. I've seen cases filed where the tenants paid the rent to one person, and the other person in the landlord's brain trust didn't know that and filed the case erroneously. So there certainly are cases that shouldn't have been filed, but this also helps get at the cases that are maybe just old enough and the landlord didn't do anything wrong, but it's still following the tenant around. The tenant kind of gets punished by the eviction case and then gets punished by the record.
Yeah.
One more follow-up, Chair Lesh.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. My last question is that generally when we do see the demographics who do rent, and maybe this is just more in the urban areas, but who generally are renters who are at times have a disadvantage in being able to fight landlords who are not treating them appropriately, what are the demographics of people generally impacted by that?
Ms. McDonough.
Mr. Chair and Representative, at the hearing that we had before the Housing Committee, Dr. Brittany Lewis testified about kind of the racial dynamics in tenancies and that evictions and the lack of the eviction expungements have an impact on protected classes, people of color, and people of disabilities.
That's a little bit. Thank you. Is that Representative
Herr? That's it. Thank you, Chair Lesh. Thank you, Mr. McDonough.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a really brief comment in response to what Representative O'Neill was talking about, the subjectivity of this being a predictor of future behavior. You know, that's what judges do all the time. They do it all the time when they sentence people. They try to predict their future behavior. It's not only about what they did in the past. It's about what is their history and their conduct show about what will happen in the future. So although it is obviously there's some subjectivity there, I don't think it's at all unreasonable to ask courts to do this. This is why we pay them all that money.
Thank you. Seriously? Okay. One more talks a lot. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It wasn't a question, but it's more just a comment, a closing comment here. And I wanted to, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
I wanted to thank Representative Herr for her comments. And I wanted to thank the testifier for his most recent comments in that. Because I appreciate that. Because there are some really bad landlords out there, just terrible people. And it's unfortunate that there are good people that have to suffer the consequences of neglectful landlords. And so, and I get that. I very much do. And I also understand, I think the intent is we don't want to, in perpetuity, harm people or tarnish them to allow them to have a restart. I get that. So with that, I think that can be accomplished in part of the language that's here in terms of going before a court and seeing if it was valid or if they were wrongfully evicted, et cetera, et cetera. But that's an entirely separate conversation from the lines 2.13 through 2.14, which is you're blinding the landlord from the ability to go beyond 3 years, even if it was a rightful eviction. And I just don't think that's enough time has passed. It's still too close to the present 3-year mark. It likely would have an impact on the ability to pay, or as Chair Scott or Representative Scott mentioned, it's not just for eviction for lack of payment. There could be other reasons. And with the good intentions, I think, of the bill author and the members who are supporting this, please understand, this is not, I'm not partisan when I say it is actions like this across the board, one-size-fits-all actions that cause rents to increase. And I genuinely believe that everybody on this committee wants to lower the cost of housing. But there are unintended consequences by language like this. And please know, when you vote yes and pass this out of committee, that's likely the impact incrementally in the ever-increasing cost of housing in the state of Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Seeing no other comments, I'll just go left. You got another one, too, Chair Scott? Go ahead.
Well, you can ask the audience if there's anyone there to testify.
Is there anyone from the audience to come out and testify? Okay. Oh, wow. Okay, we got a bunch. Come on up. Hurry up. Let's go. Please, whoever's going to testify, please come up to the table immediately, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your testimony. Go ahead. Hi. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you. I'm Sharon Sund. I am on the board at Community Mediation and Restorative Services. We are a member of Community Mediation Minnesota, which is a group of community mediating groups, organizations across the state. And together we have done over 30,000 mediations before eviction courts. And I am also a landlord. I do not want to see evictions because they cost money. And I would like to have ways that we can come up with that will require mediated solutions upstream that will create win-win situations. It sounds to me like what is being argued here is a win-lose or a lose-lose. But 6 months to an eviction, I've never had to evict someone and it's taken 6 to 9 months. But what I have had is I've had bad tenants that have problems. not necessarily bad people, but they have bad, they have tough situations. There's always an excuse. If I were able to contact a mediator and say, look, I'm having problems with this tenant 6-9 months before it gets to the point of eviction, then we can solve problems instead of allowing problems to be caused. I can tell you as a landlord, I would never, ever, ever rent to someone who had an eviction on their record. An eviction is a way to send a family into poverty, and it primarily, most of the evictions are in two zip codes in the state. They predominantly happen on the inner city, although I had property in the suburbs, and I was evicting people in suburbs, and I had property up north that I had to do an eviction with. But let us come together and create solutions. And I feel like the argument that as a landlord, I want to be able to see that eviction. I want to get good tenants. If that person has improved and they're in good standing, I don't mind renting to them. But having an eviction on the record, I automatically say no. And what kind of life does that family have? I even had a situation where I would not give that person a reference, and she called crying because she was in a homeless shelter because not one person would rent to her because I wouldn't give her a good reference because she owed me money. And so this is devastating to families. Community mediators staffed by many volunteers, we deal with the problem. Now I'm able to deal with the problem upstream. Come landlords can come and say, I got a problem with the tenant, I need a resolution, and then we can help that family find resources before it gets to the eviction. Once it gets to that stage, it's, you know, they're on the homeless, they're almost homeless. But let us, with mediation, we can deal with it upstream. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sun. Any questions for Ms. Sun? Thank you for your testimony. Okay. Next up, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. Whoever wants to go, please go. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello to you all. My name is Cecilia Shai, and I'm a member of the community Mediation Minnesota, founder of an organization called OMA Project, and we've been doing mediation, housing mediations for many organizations and families. And so I am here to support having an alternative. I have many stories. If I can share one story with you, a couple of years ago, the building that I was living actually burned, and we had families that have a lot of kids. And so instead of finding the solutions, the landlord actually evicted the families and said, go find your own place. And so if you wouldn't have mediators from other organizations come and intervene and tell us what's our right and what's the not necessarily like legal way, but to mediate and say you cannot just throw people out there. You need to figure out ways to help these families. And through that conversation, we had a successful result. So I would say that having a mediation and community interveners, I think that will shut down a lot of the issues that we have.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the bill author, does your bill have mediation in it? Am I missing something?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, no, it doesn't.
Okay, so the last two testifiers talked about mediation, but your bill is about expungement of. Correct. So, okay, just making sure that I know what we're doing here. So the last two testifiers, Mr. Chair, had been about mediation, which is not in the scope of the bill.
Fair enough. Thank you, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you.
Come on down. Next testifier, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, John Reynolds with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Thank you to Representative Hassan for keeping an open ear with us. There's a memorandum in your packet explaining our opposition to the legislation. I'll just touch on two main points. One of the previous testifiers alluded to that evictions are primarily concentrated in two zip codes in the state. The reason we know that is because eviction records are public. So there's been a lot of discussion around the eviction process nationally and locally here. The reason why we know there are where there is a problem, the reason why we know where to target resources to address the problem is because eviction records are public. Mr. McDonough alluded to the expungements generally being very rare in our judicial system. They are rare, and eviction expungements are the only circumstance where you can expunge a civil court record. So it is very narrow, but there's a reason for that, because public records are important and they matter. The second point is, and this has been discussed, eviction records, whether they result in a writ of recovery or whether they result in a settlement where the tenant gets to leave but is otherwise unfavorable, they matter. If Mr. McDonough mentioned himself as a landlord, he wanted to prevent residents who were going to cause property destruction. He wanted residents that were on good behavior. Well, the bill would allow for most eviction records to be expunged immediately or very soon after, and virtually all records to be expunged within 3 years. So eviction records contain all sorts of information about past behavior that may not be available through other public records, including non-payment, several months in a row of non-payment. That matters. Every property is different. Every property owner has a different level of risk. They have an obligation to maintain the financial integrity of the property. They have an obligation to other residents of the building to provide a safe and stable living environment. Eviction records may contain behavioral issues that you don't know about in other places, harassing behavior towards other tenants, untoward behavior towards other tenants that's not necessarily criminal and wouldn't appear anywhere else. So they are important, and the importance of them lasts long after the eviction hearing and well after 3 years. So that's my testimony. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Reynolds. I don't think I saw anyone's hands when I asked if anyone else wanted to come down and testify, so that is where we're at for now. I just have a couple of questions for you as the last person to ask questions, Mr. McDonough. Number one, when you file an expungement motion on an eviction matter, which agencies do you notice currently? If you're going to file one tomorrow, which agencies would you notice? Let's say it's in Ramsey County.
Mr. Chair, I don't notify any agencies unless I obtain an expungement. So the you notify the landlord. You have to serve the parties to the case, but you don't notify other agencies. You file it with the court, and if you obtain an expungement, then for the expungement to actually be effective, you send a copy of the expungement order to the various tenant screening agencies that report the information.
I see. Okay, does the language of the order compel those tenant screening agencies to comply with the order?
Mr. Chair, the order itself doesn't, but the statutes do require tenant screening agencies that obtain an expungement order to then take the eviction record out of their records.
Okay. Let's say I'm renting to someone, and I'm in Winona, and someone uses a tenant screening agency in La Crosse, let's say, for example. Are they compelled to comply with that order as a Wisconsin business? This does maybe most of their business in Wisconsin?
Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert on kind of separation of laws between jurisdictions. I would think that if they did business in Minnesota that they would be compelled to do that.
Okay. And my last question is this. When we passed criminal expungement, 2014 or something, who remembers that, 2013?
12 maybe, I think.
But was it 2012? Well, it was well back.
Yeah.
More than I can remember. One of the issues that was considered was the data mining agencies, mugshots.com, for example. If we pass this, what is to stop a data mining business from collecting that data and continuing to use it past the 3 years
if they're out of state, and have landlords or screening agencies even rely on that. Is there a problem associated with that, or do you think that could be easily solved?
Mr. Chair, you're asking some good questions that are testing my ability to answer. I'm not aware of there being a similar industry in the area of landlord-tenant, I'm aware of what you're talking about in terms of the mugshot industry. I have not seen that industry kind of rear its head in the landlord-tenant area. Tenant screening agencies tend to be local. There's less of a national market in tenancies from, you know, various states. You find tenant screening agencies to be, for the most part, local. There are some credit reporting agencies that have moved into kind of the business of reporting nationally, but I'd say, from my experience, it's still a relatively local phenomenon.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to highlight that this bill is consistent with the recommendation in the report from the Governor's Task Force on Housing, which states limit eviction reporting until a court judgment is rendered. This conversation has been about protecting bad behavior, but that's not what we're doing. If you are a good landlord and you're treating your tenants right, this doesn't have any impact on the people that you're renting from. But if you are a landlord who's taking advantage of people, which I'm from a district that's 70% people of color, and we had 330 people sleeping outside, and many of them came from as a result of evictions. So we are not protecting bad characters here. We're not protecting bad behaviors, but we're advocating for tenants who don't have the voice or the means to advocate for themselves. If any of you have ever been to housing court, it's a depressing place to be. It's full of people of color, and all the landlords, majority of the landlords, are from mainstream background, and they're all fighting for evictions that many of them are wrongfully, or many of them should not even have happened. So I ask for your support on this bill, and just highlight that if we want to talk about fairness, let's talk about fairness. Who does this impact? This impacts people of color and indigenous communities predominantly. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. Representative Hassan's motion is that House File, 1511, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hassan. You're on your way. Representative Dean, come on down. You're the next contestant. And Representative Dean, I understand that you got a Peace in the Valley amendment. Is that accurate?
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Butel. Chair and committee members, yes, we do. And I believe that the House researcher, Ms. Mullen, or Nathan Hopkins actually have it?
It's oral, though.
What's that? It's going to be an oral amendment to add to this.
And we checked in with Chair Scott on this, too.
We have checked in with Chair Scott.
To the extent that we can favor brevity on this, considering everyone's been duly notified, that would be helpful. So go ahead. Hold on a second. Chair moves that House File 2062 be recommended to be placed in the general register. Members also will probably also lay this over for the omnibus bill, but the motion is going to be to send it to the general register. Go ahead, Representative Dean.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and members, this bill addresses data collection under the workforce certificate of compliance that are classified relative to workforce certificate compliance in the program at the state. It's really some language that adds some clarity, and I'm going to let my testifier actually speak to it specifically because he knows the ins and outs of it, and I know the 30,000
level. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Butel. I'm the Public Policy Director with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. As Representative Dean said, this is a Department of Human Rights agency bill that addresses a data classification issue that basically provides some clarity for the state of Minnesota's business partners who have a workforce certificate of compliance. Right now, under the equal pay certificate of compliance provision of the statute, there's a specific data classification. This provides a similar data classification within the Minnesota Human Rights Act for that data, so these folks will have specific and easy clarity about this information. We worked with Mr. Elling, with Minkoji, and Mr. Neumeister to come up with some language that works with everyone, and with the amendment that will be offered, we had an agreement about this that provides some specific provisions in addition to the current language about basically applications will be public as well. So of the data that's collected right now, generally it's already pretty much wholesale under the trade secrets provision under Chapter 13.37, but this just provides some added clarity with the state's business partners. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butel. Any questions for Mr. Butel? Okay, seeing none, then why don't we go to the amendment? If I could have research state the amendment, because I think you have that master copy. Someone has a master copy over there.
Mr. Chair and members, so this amendment is going to add a new sentence at line 1, page 1, line 10, and also add a new beginning to that sentence that begins with the commissioners. So the amendment, page 1, line 10, delete the word the and insert applications, forms, or similar documents submitted by a business seeking a certificate of compliance are public data. A letter that states the, that's the end of the amendment.
Okay. That's the whole amendment.
Yes.
Okay, and for the record, members, I'm going to forego my customary objection to the pluralization of data because it is a collective noun. It should be singular, but I've already fought in that fight a couple times, and I'm tired of it. So anyway, any comments on the oral amendment? Seeing none, then all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Dean, to your bill as amended.
It's a good bill. I appreciate stakeholders coming together and getting an agreement on language that will make it easier for it to move forward, and I thank you for your support.
Thank you. Any discussion on the bill as amended? Great. Seeing none, then the chair's motion is that House File 2062 as amended be recommended to be placed on a general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. You're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Sorry you had to wait for that first one, Representative Dean. I don't know you're actually going to be this short, but if I did, maybe I would have switched it around. But nice job. Thanks.
Being short is something I struggle with my whole life.
All right. Okay. Okay, the last two are mine, so Representative Mueller is going to take the con. And
it's just been I think these have been pretty short.
Okay.
All right. Yes, members, we're going to start with House File 2004. Chair Lesh, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would.
All right. Chair Lesh moves that House File 2004 be recommended to be placed on the general register. So we have the bill before us. Go ahead and describe it, please.
Thank you. I'm going to defer to Mr. Butel on this, who can describe the bill.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Butel. Go ahead and introduce yourself one more time, and you can begin.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. My name is Scott Butel, Public Policy Director with Minnesota Department of Human Rights. This is a second Department of Human Rights agency technical bill that deals with a very specific data situation in which case parties where a case has been submitted to us for investigation decide to withdraw that case and then file a private right of action in court, which happens several times a year. Currently, the way the statute is written, we actually have to go through and redact that data before giving them their own information back, which we then see they go into court. During the discovery phase, they get that exact same information in unredacted form. So this basically will allow just those case parties to get that data for just their case in unredacted form. So it's very simple. It's very limited. It doesn't apply to folks who aren't one of the two parties to that case, or to, you know, members of the public or the media or whatever. It maintains all those classifications the same. So thank you.
All right. Thanks. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Butel, Bill Author? Anyone from the audience wish to testify? All right. Chair Lesh? Chair Mariani, you're not coming out to testify about this bill, are you?
Sure.
Is there any final comments you'd like to make?
It's good, Bill. Members, please vote yes.
All right. So Chair Lesh moves that House File 2004 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right.
What was the motion? Oh, forget it.
All right.
General Register, okay.
Yeah. Members, just hold on just 1 second, please.
What's that? Ways and Means? Yeah. But what? Got to push it back. Well, what should the motion be then? So, we can ask research about this. This is a blank appropriation bill, okay, and it's to fund the Legislative Commission on Data Practices. So our deadline is not Friday anyway, so we could lay this over for possible inclusion or send it somewhere else and we'd be fine, right? Okay. Let's send it to Ways and Means. We're going to send it to Ways and Means.
You want to fall back and regroup?
Huh? Kind of, yeah. Get our bearings, call in the Rangers and... Not the Iron Rangers, mind you.
Retreat on this one.
Yeah, thank you. Watch my six. We're going to have, Madam Chair, we're going to have the motion be to move it to Ways and Means, just to kind of cover our backs, and then, I don't know.
Okay. Great. Yeah, and our CLA is coming back in, too. So, all right. So House File 804 is the next bill we have up. Representative Lesh, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, and members, we haven't been in this committee before on this bill, have we? It's the first time it's here. I'm sure I've had this somewhere else, but the memory is getting, who's GovOps, okay. Memory's getting blurry this time of year. Members, this is the Representative Holberg.
And Chair Lesh, I don't think we actually moved your bill.
Okay.
Let's go ahead and make
sure. Chair, my motion is that this bill be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Representative Holberg, you know, one of her many legacies around here was to get this Legislative Commission on Data Practices and Personal Data Privacy up and running and have us work on it and appoint members of the House and Senate to it to make sure that we were on top of the complexities of Chapter 13 and other data practices issues and personal privacy issues that came through the legislature and rely on legislators who could be subject matter experts following the lead of non-legislator subject matter experts. And so this continues the Holberg legacy in that vein, and I think it's a good thing that we do this, and so this creates more money to extend it out to 2026.
All right. Thanks. Yes, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Lesh, could you just kind of give me a reason why we went 7 years and not 2 years, 10 years, no sunset? Could you just kind of explain that a little bit, please? Because I don't know anything about the commission.
Chair Lesh.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Barr, I can't. I think originally we put it in for that amount of time, and so this is an extension of that amount of time. I always like sunsets around here.
because, I don't know, 7 years from now, we could be dealing with completely different stuff, and we still have this thing hanging around, but it's folded into a much bigger commission that we're still dealing with on stuff. So that's why I prefer to have a sunset. As to whether we have a shorter one, you know, I don't know. I feel like it's be kind of a pain to have to keep coming back. I feel very confident that 7 years is a good amount of time that we can be sure that this commission is going to have a useful role around here, at least until, I don't know, everyone transcends into the internet in 2029 or something. I don't know. Huh?
Skynet.
Yeah, Skynet takes over in 2027. I'm not sure when that's going to happen. So, yeah.
I see Mr. Neumeister. Do you want to testify? Why don't you come on forward? Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister, and it's a pleasure to support the extension of this Privacy Commission. This is a commission that has helped all of you as policymakers on some of the issues, license plate readers, body cameras, technology in terms of surveillance. This past year, they were starting to talk about DNA and private companies. One of the things that you may have realized in the past year, there was a big clash between our privacy consent laws for medical records. This commission did due diligence work to parse out some of those, and some of those things are being discussed today. One of the things that I would like to suggest, and it's important, and reason why this commission was, in the past years, there used to be subcommittees on data practices and privacy in the House and in the Senate. But because of dynamics change, that has not happened in 10 years. And that was one of the forefronts of why it was important for this type of group to happen. And there's 5 from the House and 5 from the Senate. Now, for the future, I encourage that there be one full-time staff. There was a part-time staff person at $35,000, was appropriated in 2015, I believe, but it wasn't funded for 2.5 years. But people know, with the experience from the commission now, to get on board and to make sure legislators and policymakers and folks get educated about all this stuff, hopefully there will be one full-time person, get on board, and start looking at some of the issues. And one of the things I would like to suggest that be looked at, other than just privacy, is the importance of how citizens and residents of Minnesota can get access to public information. Because that's been an issue over the past couple of years with lawsuits. Tony Webster, there's a name you may have heard. And at least with the extension of this, the commission can start dealing in some of those areas too. So I wholly support this, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and also Peggy Scott, who's been, both these two folks have been working bipartisanly. There might be some diffs, but working in a congenial issue on privacy and openness in government, and that's one, as someone who's been here a long time, I really appreciate all that. So thank you very much, and let's, as they say, go to it and do it.
Thank you. We appreciate your enthusiasm at this time of night, too, especially. Any other questions right now? Anyone else from the audience wish to testify? All right. Chair Lesh, any final comments?
Well, I would just like to thank members. One thing about the data practices expertise area, is that you've got a lot of people, including Mr. Neumeister, who are working on all this stuff for free. You get some really solid thinking done by intelligent, learned individuals on how to make sure we keep our government open, which keeps you freer, and how we protect your personal property, which also keeps you freer. And they generally don't get paid for it. So many people come to this table and they sit here and they're getting paid on a contract, or they have a business interest in it or something. Some of the purest legislation that you see come through the Minnesota House of Representatives is on this data practices piece, and it's all for the good of the people of Minnesota, and I'm really proud to be a part of it for that reason. These are really good people to work with. So I ask for your support.
Thank you. Chair Lesh moves that House File 804 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
If you could just, Madam Chair, if I could have you or if I could have the CA speak to what we're doing tomorrow, because I don't have my paper here.
Okay, so we're hearing six or seven bills. They're all on the committee page, but it's 1140.
If you, Ms. Ganani, if you could speak into your mic. You got a mic there. There you go.
Okay.
No, you never use
it. I'm not supposed to speak into the mic. So yeah, we're not meeting tomorrow evening, but we are extending. We're meeting past 11:15. I do realize in my original email I said we can stay until 12:30, but we can't because there's a floor session. So hopefully we'll wrap up by 10 to 12 or so. Two of the bills, one we're recalling, which is Representative Cantrell's bill 724. That should be very quick, and then we have a couple quick ones and then some a little bit more complicated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Johnson.
Chair, dealing with that schedule, just so you're aware, our party, our this side of the aisle has caucus scheduled for 11:30.
Well,
tomorrow night, right? Until 6:30.
So, are you doing two caucuses tomorrow? The 11:30 and the evening caucus. You're doing the caucus before the floor session.
What are you guys talking about?
I'll be here.
Okay, well, we'll figure that out somehow. I don't
know.
Well,
the way I'm working on the agenda right now, and we should be done by 11:30, actually, but, you know.
But we're looking over here at you.
Yeah. Yeah, do you hear that, Lucille?
That corner.
Perfect. That would be fantastic.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, all right. The meeting is adjourned.